You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Oh, the Johnny Rocket Launchpad is liberty. Each week, we strive to bring you the best guests in talk radio. The Johnny Rocket Launchpad delivers weekly interviews of noteworthy politicians, experts, and activists. The Johnny Rocket Launchpad is bringing the party to the Libertarian Party and launching ideas in your direction. Check us out at johnnyrocketlaunchpad.com. You can hear me, Kurt Nelson, and the beautiful Heather Nixon talk about the ideas of liberty. Rock and roll.
Hey there, Liberty lovers. This is Mark Clare of the Lions of Liberty podcast, where we strive to bring you great conversations about the ideas of liberty 3 days a week, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Check us out at lionsofliberty.com.
Hey guys, this is Roger Paxton, and if you're fed up with the government running every single aspect of your life, but you're not listening to the Lava Flow podcast yet, then what's wrong with you? Check us out at thelavaflow.com, or just go back to sucking up to the government. The Lava Flow podcast, striking the root every single episode.
We are supported by listeners like you. Donate per month or make a one-time donation through PayPal or Patreon at wearelibertarians.com. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. We Are Libertarians brings you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves. We explain to you what the hell is happening in our world today and how we can fix it by thinking differently. This is a podcast brought to you by the We Are Libertarians Network. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, share this episode with friends, and support us through PayPal or Patreon at wearelibertarians.com. We are supported by listeners like you, so $1 per episode by pledging $5 a month helps us grow. We are always taking your questions and comments via email at editor@wearelibertarians.com. We don't have a Dear Leader letter for this episode, so you guys need to get on it. You need to write us, editor@wearelibertarians. We will take life advice. Here's the thing about Dear Leader and Greg Lenz and all of the people involved in We Are Libertarians. We are experts in literally everything.
Millennials, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah, that is the voice of Greg Lenz. Also with us is Creighton Harrington. And so, yeah, I am very successful. Greg is very successful. We can give you relationship advice. we can give you car advice. We have a woman on staff who loves to give car advice, especially to Harry. No, we can give you career advice if you're thinking about making a move.
Meme
advice, fix.
We are like the meme stock market. I call us the brain trust of modern America.
Fix the memes. We did an episode on the CIA last episode. We didn't even mention the meme task force that they had set up.
Medic warfare. Oh my God.
I didn't think you were serious. Explain it.
So, memetic warfare is basically just how to create the groundswell for the CIA through digital cyber warfare. So, how do you instantaneously create replicate like a narrative?
Right.
And infiltrate. And so that's what they had planned. They sort of mapped out a center and hacker base, the U.S. consulate in Frankfurt, where they were conducting these this digital memetic warfare. And lost the fortune, quite frankly. They don't even know they're engaged in a war. So I think their means were...
Let's put that in perspective. Like, you have a network of neckbeards in their basement just trying their damnedest to think of the most shocking, absurd memes possible.
Oh, that's the thing is, we'll turn the trash dove into a Hitler thing. And next thing you know, they're putting the trash dove and creating a fake story about him out he and Pepe are Egyptian gods.
The media picks up on this and, like, reports it, like, it's actually, like, news.
See,
they literally have no idea what the hell they're doing. Like, the mainstream media, when it comes to this stuff, are like your grandma looking at an iPhone. Like, they have no idea what the hell's going on.
So, we've been looking back. We looked back last episode. We'll look back next episode on the 5 years, 200 episodes of We Are Libertarians. You know, one of the, I mean, it's really incredible how, this podcast has changed the course of history. It's a huge podcast. It's a history making podcast. Let me explain why. Do you want to talk about
building this narrative?
Okay. It involves you divulging some information. I know you're not good at that. Okay. It started in 2013 with Creighton Harrington, and we were doing an episode with Greg Creighton, and I think Gina might have been there, and we were talking about 4chan, and Greg didn't even know what 4chan was.
The chat?
Yeah.
I honestly was not sure how to pronounce meme when I joined.
Right. Meme.
Neither did Chris.
No. I called it memes.
The early ones were joking about it, like memes.
Memes. Yeah, what are these memes, these nerds?
What's funny is you guys, you talk about all this stuff that I've done with you guys, and I haven't been on the show in like a year and a half.
At least.
So all of these like 6,000 plus people, probably like 20 of them even know who I
am. Exactly.
It's like, I am a godfather, yo.
Yeah, you're one of the OGs on this.
Council of Five Families.
Right?
Five Families.
I'm literally like Elrond over here.
If you... if you look at the I go by seniority, so even though Greg is much more important to this podcast than you, Creighton, when I list out that
when I list out
the names on the podcast of who was in the description, I always go by seniority, and so in this podcast it'll be Chris Spangle, Creighton Harrington, and Greg Lenz discuss. So.
Spangle started pirating more of my content. I said, "Hey, you can come if you want."
Yeah, I'm a content whore. I had met James Neese. I didn't realize that James Neese was one of the original mods on 4chan. You know, Greg was introduced to 4chan on an episode after we showed a particular grandmother meme, and just Google this and you can see the meme. It's
bundle of sticks.
No. It is a grandmother, and so we were talking about 4chan, and Greg goes, "I don't know what that is," and Creighton goes to 4chan.
Oh, this is what happened. I remember like it was yesterday because it's just been so earth-shattering since then. What it was we were in, like, I guess 99% of the people know that we have like a Facebook chat where we plan all these episodes.
Right.
And what had happened was Chris said something about James Neese having been involved with the creation of 4chan.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, I don't know if it's true or not.
It is. But, he has mod rights on B.
But anyway, does he?
And Paul.
Dude,
yep.
Straight up God, yo. But he, I did not believe when I heard this. So I, for some reason, I was like, maybe there's proof on 4chan. Because God knows everyone on there is not anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on there to look for proof, and I swear to God, the first thing at the top of B, the top of the webpage, is a picture of a
a lovely church picture of a
widow,
like a smiling grandma,
right? And it says, "I'm a."
You can beat this out.
No.
It says, "I am a huge faggot. Please rate my face." On this grandma.
You gotta Google it.
And I was like,
it's my favorite. Like, it's also the first really, you know, brutalist thing I ever experienced.
Right. So I saw
it.
I was like, immediately, because I had been on 4chan before this, like, and I had been like, I need to avoid this at all costs.
Right.
So I bit the bullet and I went to look for proof, and the first thing that pops up is this picture.
Why ask her? What is it? And this is it.
I shared it in the chat. I avoid 4chan for years. I go back to find proof of Chris's statement, and this is the first picture. And I shared this, and like to this day, it's like the picture of our Facebook.
Oh yeah, because it was so. Because at the time in 2013, I was still a respectable member of society. We all were, and like it was just one of those things that was the edgiest, most. That was the edgiest photo we'd ever seen in our life.
I knew at that moment, my life, that was like, I ascended the cave.
Right.
I still remember is the next message is that Greg's like, "I am literally crying."
Oh, meme tears.
Like,
yeah.
These are my people.
I had limited Photoshop skills then, and so, but I could cut things out. And one of my favorite things since childhood has always been I would get magazines and cut out faces and put them on other. I was memeing since when I was a kid, man. When I would get bored in class and I'd have a newspaper and I'd just like start marking up the paper, drawing in mustaches, memeing, all kinds of things. And that was, see, kids, a newspaper is a blog on paper. It's think of it as a Facebook status on newsprint, and then I would cut out the memes and make my memes on high school.
Cartoonists.
Right, exactly. And so I loved it, and then so I would do that with Photoshop stuff, and then I said, Greg, you really should get GIMP or Photoshop and try this out. And
well,
so
my aviary had just come out.
Yeah.
I
taught him how to meme.
You realize what you've done?
It was a software of a service Photoshop startup that didn't have any users called Aviary, and it became Pixlr, P-I-X.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm like, all right, hell, I'll try it. And so I'm like literally not, I'm saving pictures to my desktop and then uploading them into the web-based editor, not knowing I can copy and paste. And then I forget what the very first meme of you was, but you wanted it for something.
I forget.
The one of you as Marilyn Monroe singing happy birthday, Mr. President. That was the
yeah.
That was the first one I think I had that went viral because Julie Borowski shared it.
Yeah.
You guys are my kind of libertarian.
Yeah, and so and now you use what app on your Android phone?
A combination depending on what I need to do, but primarily I use the Pixlr app and then photo layers for, you know, adding faces. And I have a vast and extensive Spangle library dating back to 2013.
We're putting together for the membership thing that we're going to be creating a Spangle meme database and yeah.
Mimetica.
And there are how many memes that you have of me?
I'm at 500 and I'm not even close.
Right.
Over 500. Like, I did it for 3 straight hours one night and was like, fuck this, man.
Keep going, please.
I have autism this hard.
I've asked for a year. I need this. I need this done.
4 hour period.
Yeah. And, so. And he spawned people who are not as good at it, but right.
I designed it to get you laid.
Exactly. That
part of I made it a strategy when you were getting divorced and weren't around as much. I was like,
right.
You know what? We're like, we have these listeners. They're complaining if we're not. Like, we need like a hero, a star. So I'm like, and you're going through your divorce.
He's the hero.
Well, that's
we
the
need.
Thing is, like,
but not the one you deserve.
I've been reading the fake Steve Jobs blog, fakesteve.net. And in it, he has all these minions that refer to him as dear leader. And so I'm just like, this is perfect.
Right.
You have an authoritarian dictator as the leader of the libertarian movement. Turned him into Kim Jong-il and went from there.
Yeah, and so if you go onto my Facebook page, or Greg's, which you can access on the front page of We Are Libertarians, or the We Are Libertarians Facebook page, you can look through some of those old memes. They're hysterical. Yeah, they're really good. Yeah.
Probably get like a part-time job.
Get on Fiverr
now, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I basically get paid to meme for a living. So, and then Aaron and Tad Western have both, they're great memers as well.
Guy on the internet that's a listener keeps messaging me and sending me pictures of Jimmy, the quarterback of the Seahawks. What's his name? I always forget his name.
The black guy.
Russell Wilson.
Right, Russell Wilson.
But instead, it's Russell Wilson's picture, and it says Jimmy Russell, and I had no idea what this was. And I asked Spang, I'm like, this guy wants to meet for lunch at Roy's.
Yeah.
You know, I remember him. He's really weird. He doesn't make eye contact.
Aaron donated some stuff to, if you've heard Amanda's story, episode 144, where you can download our new podcast called The Cost, and you can go and listen to it there. He donated some stuff for Amanda during that time period, and he showed up and he didn't make eye contact. He was super awkward, but he was a big fan, and then he's super social and like awkwardly, weirdly aggressive socially. Aaron Ewert is aggressively social, and I don't like it.
As he is as social as you are hydrated.
Yes. And so, and then we met his cousin Tyler.
Met's a strong word.
We were forced into a chat with
I got added to brutalism like as soon as I have lunch with Aaron.
And right.
He's really not that ass.
Right. He's actually a good dude.
God, he does that shit.
Yeah.
Oh
well,
God.
This is right after the breakup, like brutalists and whatever the cucks.
Right. Right after the Tucker article.
Yeah. And so
there were all these brutalist chat groups on Facebook.
Well, I mean, to be fair, there's like a Facebook group. Like a million of them for every Bigfoot has got
right.
A secret Facebook group.
Yeah, but it wasn't that way in the beginning. In the beginning, the Ostrich Kingdom and some other groups, I mean, they were like, there were two or three, and that was it. And everybody was in them before it started splintering.
If anybody's been a libertarian for more 5 minutes, you know that it's a tight-knit network. Like,
right.
Everyone's like one person removed from everybody else.
Exactly right, yeah. And so then we got put into this chat with our friend John Upton, and...
Well, I added to Brutalism after lunch.
Right.
And I asked Aaron, I'm like, are you sure there's nothing I can say or do that'll get me in
trouble?
And he goes, oh yeah, he's like, these are the meanest, most awful people on the internet. I'm like, are you sure?
I remember this.
And he's like, yeah, I'm sure. I'm like, why? And I'm like, oh, I just want to make sure I'm focused at my bounds.
Because Greg has taught me a lesson.
Greg is a bounds.
Well, I need to know the boundaries because I'm going to find where they are.
Greg loves to push boundaries, as do I. And so Greg has taught me a lesson. Listen, if you have to make a choice, you can capitulate and say you're sorry and bite the bullet, or you have to become a monster and you have to live with that monster.
There's no alternative. Like, there's no middle ground.
Speaking of which, I just...
Either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become a...
Speaking of which, on an unrelated note, I just want to again offer an invitation to my friend Rob Kendall. I miss his friendship, and I'm sorry for all the things that you did to me, and I want you to come and apologize for your hurtful words and for all of the things that you have said about me on the internet, all the untruths and the lies. Monday night, Morty's Comedy Joint at 7 p.m. You are extended an invitation to We Are Libertarians Live to come and apologize to both me and the We Are Libertarians Empire.
It's all about our listeners.
Thus, you have to understand that my listeners and I are one, okay? We are the same person, essentially. I derive all of my dear leader's powers through our listenership. And when somebody comes in and hurts the Empire the way that Rob has hurt the Empire, he owes all of us an apology. He owes you an apology. He owes Mittens an apology. And I think it would be the right thing to do. So please, Monday night, 7 p.m. at Morty's Comedy Joint, Creighton and Chris Galt, the final rematch. They will be live and in person together for the first time since the fight.
I'll be honest, Galt's getting him at a good time because he actually had a rare lifting incident and hurt his ankle slightly.
Yeah.
Saying you're not, you know,
I've got.
He's got to talk into that mic, bro.
So
you bring them. Seriously.
I dare you.
Look at me, Creighton. Look at me right now.
You have to literally, we'll tie one arm behind
you. You bring those boxing gloves or you're not invited.
And we'll tie your
I'm dead serious.
Ankle, and then he gets to have an
open
come after you.
So, and I will be demonstrating the fight, okay, which I can do a pitch-perfect reenactment of the fight. Again,
I'm 27.
Rob Kendall, you are invited to come and apologize to me Monday night at 7 p.m. at Morty's Comedy Joint for our 5th anniversary 200th episode party. So you have to become the monster that you can live with. So Greg gets into this brutalism chat.
I'm very upfront about it. I'm conscientious, saying, what can I do that I can't do?
Right.
What is absolutely taboo?
Where's the line?
They're the most brutal people on the internet. You can do anything you want.
There is a line. Oh, really?
Yes.
I'm like, okay, fine. And so I'm watching how things devolve, and they're like some truly awful things.
Horribly offensive
things.
I had to leave the group.
They think they're going to haze me. And so, like, they pull me in, and I'm like, haha, that's funny. You know, I do the whole Twitter Bob, if you're familiar with 8 Mile. Where you make fun of yourself, and I'm like, well, this is good. And then this one guy in particular just won't stop, and he's a member of the alt-right now. And I'm just like, okay. All right, that's a good profile picture you have there. And I take his young son and slap it on a fleshlight. And call it the Murph Light 2000.
And then explain
to him that my night's going to be mainly
fucking his kid in the face.
Probably. Maybe impregnating it. This is the language I might have used. It set off a shitstorm and brutalism. People are messaging me what a horrible person.
Kids' face on a fleshlight is the line.
And it immediately happened. 500 comments later, people messaging me, you're horrible. That you can't talk about children. I'm like, I screenshot my combo with Aaron. Like, I asked him what I could say. He's like, we're going to find you. Like, all these people on the internet.
Shit.
And I don't know what's going on.
No.
First day.
He's being very, very kind to himself. He didn't stop there. Like,
oh, no, because then it turned into...
He just was like, oh, you guys, like, oh, you want to come at me? Come at me, bro.
How do you like the fastball?
Like, he just went off.
It was really...
But that ended up with a bunch of people quit because There's a fine line of brutalism where children are all blown up.
Apparently, face fucking a child's not a good thing, Greg. Right. Jesus.
Said he doesn't have a red line. I'm serious. That's what he told me. Face to face. Right. I don't have a red line of brutalism. My brutalism is free range.
And then we added James' niece.
He gets Jonathan Upton, the listener, gets added. So this has been we were banned shit posters at this point.
Right.
We're experts in offending people.
Right.
Like, we've been banned by chicks on the right at this point. Like, you know, they tried to say that Harry's hair looked good the way it was or something like that. And so I was like, why are you racist? And he just wouldn't stop. And then I pulled in all the brutalists and they did a
descended. Yeah.
Chicks on the right page. And we're all blocked forever. And he still listens to Mock and Daisy and Traitor.
Yep. So John gets control of the group.
Admin rights alone.
Yeah, which is dangerous fucking territory.
Incredible act. This kind of restraint is only comparable to George Washington, you know, stopping after, you know, his term.
Right.
Upton removes access for himself, but just hands it to James. No one else can stop. 15 minutes till they were screaming publicly at Upton on Facebook. What have you done?
James.
Like, I'm going to dox you, bro. You're going to be on B's front page.
True. No, what have you done?
That's when I knew that all the mod stuff was 100% true.
James at the time. James's Facebook name at the time was James Muddick Neist.
And the next day, it was
Brutalist Overlord James Neist. He got in the group and declared him their supreme commander, Brutalist Overlord.
I've never seen autism like this. His memes are impeccable. He doesn't use any like quality.
It's just Jesus. It's just MS Paint.
That's the lefty thing that he goes too hard in his memes. You know, his favorite meme is of Spangle, OG niece, that he used paint on Spangle to cheering the destruction of his town.
Yes. He said, I'm going to be a dad. I went too hard in the paint.
This is a former Libertarian Party son. The guy that won brought him in as advisor. He got signatures by going to truck stops and offering tall.
He literally did that. He literally got. Oh.
The first time I asked, I'm like, niece, like, you're always around. Like, are you babysitting or like watching your kid? He's like, oh, God, yeah, man. I just showed her how to shotgun. Are you seriously? Oh, yeah.
Oh, we got to have niece there Monday.
This is the guy so serious about World of Warcraft when he and his team got to a certain point in mid-sex with his girlfriend. He jumped up, went over, defeated the dragon onto the half of his team, and then went back and finished.
You're all
joking! He actually, mid-sex, stopped to go defeat a dragon so his team
I love that he was monitoring this in the middle of sex.
You know, that thing is, it was so like you had to wait until the dragon became available. He hops, runs over his computer, slays the dragon. I'm sure gives it some sort of
dragon
in one
way.
And then goes, how about that? And then jumps back on.
Unreal.
Oh my God.
He's a father of two. Somehow I'm an irresponsible person.
This has been the journey that is We Are
It's been so much fun.
Either we've influenced it, or it's a it's coincided.
So now, Greg Lenz, you have become a mod on 8chan poll. Explain 8chan.
8chan, though, is way different than 4chan. Like, they're way less degenerates, and they're way more...
Really?
Really. Like, they make the memes, but they don't do any of the shit posting. So, like, they're real creative people.
Right.
And, like, I am stunned. Like, the level of the people, like, the research they do, and the things they've read, like, I love it. But I'm real restrictive, too. So they'll give mods to people that are, like, err on the side too much. Like, you'll flag anything that's conspiratorial or something.
Mm.
And so that's why they want to keep it like a tight community. But then it gets named... What was it? They were the people that put up the... They came up with the flyers at IUPUI. There's a fellow IUPUI shit poster on 8chan poll that put up the flyers around campus...
just recently?
Yeah, and it caused an outrage.
The white.
Yeah, made the WTHR. Oh, that was planned on 8chan poll.
Oh my god!
And I was like, "Who's an IUPUI kid? Oh, why don't you do this? Why don't you fan those flames a little bit?"
So
I was half thinking it was you.
Oh god, no!
Pull that mic closer to you, Creighton. Pull that bass all the way. Pull the bass to the edge.
WTHR, how offended he had made the entire community.
Yeah, I just am so proud. Had we known several years ago that James Neese, Greg Lins, Tad Western could help get Donald Trump elected
right,
their memes.
The greatest meme poll ever is when you're patrolling a 4chan anime porn board and all of a sudden you find one of the presidential candidates amusing, so you invoke a long-forgotten frog god who knows memes to make him president for the keks.
That's right. Greg knows a meme by heart.
No,
it's like
wrong.
Shakespeare in Sonnet.
Nope. True, though.
Yeah.
What's funny is, looking back, you know, we should have seen this coming because during Obama's administration, Anonymous is when Anonymous showed up. Anonymous is from 4chan.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And like back then, it was just
that's
like,
where the name comes from. Is on
Anon. Everybody goes on. There's Anon. And you know, back then it was just like, oh, this is a hacking group, you know, and all this. No one really thought about it as 4chan. But, like, people who knew a 4chan was like, dude, this is 4chan. Like, this is real. And next thing you know, they get a president.
Then it turned like, that's how these people, that's what I mean when they're creative, is you see that, like, oh, there's this frog. Feels good, man. And
yeah.
They're trying to brand it as a hate symbol. They go and find a forgotten Egyptian god, Keck, that has a frog's head on a pharaoh's body and sitting in front of a square rectangle, and there's this... Like, it looks like the infinity symbol. Like, this is on a hieroglyphic. They say it's Keck sitting at a computer altering the universe, that he's been long dormant, and it's time to bring him back and create an entire fictional religion and narrative about how Keck changed the world and start praying to him.
And it's
so funny.
He elected a president.
It literally, the news media reported on this story.
That's
Hillary Clinton, none of this would have been ever in the press if she didn't give the speech in San Diego about Nazi frogs.
That is why it is, there's a meme warfare center.
They are.
Yep.
They. But the thing is, they didn't know they were at war until they got the WikiLeaks scandal. They created the thing to scan it all. Someone just stupidly posts meme, and that brings up in the 8,000-page document leak. Any screenshots like, we've been fighting a war we weren't even aware of. We beat the globalists.
How bad they are.
What is your most viral meme that you think, if you mention it, people might recognize it?
The most viral Donald... It was definitely... I got in on the Donald Trump memes earlier because I just found them great.
Yeah.
You know, and so...
We're aware.
So it would have been Trumptimus Prime, him as Optimus Prime, got a lot of use. The Academy Awards, one of Trump... the award for best actor goes to Donald Trump playing the Republican. Dustin Reed always asks me because he'll send me pictures of screenshots of when he sees my memes on 4chan.
That's funny.
I post it on wall first, and I'm like, no, I've never, you know, I don't post on 4chan at all, only 8chan.
That's funny.
That one week, Glenn Beck's people were, Pat and Stu were criticizing the meme I made of Ted Cruz. The Ted Cruz on the cover of Liar Liar, the Jim Carrey.
Yep.
And they were getting mad about it. And then that was the first time two of my memes showed up on poll. And I wrote a post about it, like, this is arguably the greatest moment of my life. Talking about it on a huge, you know, conservative podcast about shaming Lion Ted. I just got screenshots from people saying, that's your meme.
That's so funny. Yeah, it is certainly been something else. Harry, are you leaving? Harry's leaving. He's tired like me. He's been playing computers.
What sort of zero-day exploit did you put on?
Yeah, I'm sure you did something to that computer, didn't you? Go ahead and pick that mic there. Yeah. All right, don't worry about that.
Stupid Apple keyboard. No, I thought about it. I really did. But, you know, you made me promise not to do anything. I did, because I was going to leave my land turtle here on the network, so I could just dial in and just mess with stuff. Just I did
take control webcams.
Yeah. Now it's just almost like I almost feel like just like doing some small little like stuff to him, like just to mess with him.
I'd know it was you. I would know that it was you, Harry, and if you'd break into my drop cam and see me nude, that's on you, bud. You're not going to want to see that. Ask James Neese.
I sat over here, and I created this one little script I was going to do. I almost feel bad not even doing it or just saying it here. It was pretty cool. I used it on my ducky script that was going to hook it up to your Mac Air so it would just take a photo of the camera at you, and it just instantly put the text underneath. I'm a huge bundle of sticks. Right by my face. Our private trailer board to the Facebook chat.
Yes.
Honestly. Honestly, I wouldn't even be mad. That would have been very funny. Don't do that. Wow. So, great memories. A walk down meme lane. Yeah.
How much has happened? It's stunning.
It is amazing. So,
talk about wives that left.
Oh, yeah. I've been married and divorced. Creighton, you've had several girlfriends. Now one's marrying your best friend. You know, that sort of thing.
Savage.
And my brother, he tried to get in there. He slid in DMs for a while, so we could have been Peter and Loss. Yeah. Now, when the two of them, you lived with them for a while. Now, when the two of them were having, did you shout out tips?
That's so awkward. It's pretty awkward if they're listening to this right now. You can't respond.
It's not awkward for me, but it's definitely.
Thanks, Harry.
See you, Harry.
Bye. Harry got the door there.
He's really earned the quarters to stay here.
What?
Some room on the couch.
I don't have room to build a shed on the back porch. No. I've got one across the street, but okay, so I'm curious, and I'm not going to stick through this whole episode because I am beat and I won't add much. And I want to just get up and walk around. As you can hear, I'm losing my brain. Now, Creighton, I am curious to hear who you voted for president.
Johnson.
Gary Johnson. Yeah. My favorite meme ever was he had a GIF in 2012 that he posted on Twitter, and it was a guy. No, you, Creighton. A guy throwing a paper airplane into the ocean, and it came back and hit him in the face.
Development.
Yeah. And he goes and he runs out and he throws the paper airplane, it swoops back, hits him right in the forehead. Yeah.
Blowing it back into his face. And
he captioned that how it feels to vote for Gary Johnson today. Which I thought was very funny.
Accurate commentary. My favorite was his response after the epic fight.
Right.
Because it had been a blowout. You and I are squealing and shaking.
Oh, shit.
Are you talking about...
Let's tell that story next week, okay? We're going to document the whole Chris...
Tell the meme or no?
Yeah, go ahead.
To this day, I still use Ron Burgundy. Well, that escalated quickly. Any awkward argument that has resulted in silence, that is what I use.
They got into it the other day. It's going to be an epic Monday night fight. The final battle between Creighton and Galt. So if there's any graphic designers out there who can make a fight poster for me, that'd be awesome. Yeah, and if you're in the Indianapolis area and you want to be an intern for We Are Libertarians, hit me up. We're looking for some interns.
Don't expect to get paid.
No, there will be no pay, and there will be we might may be able to do college credits.
You might have to pay us.
Yeah, honestly.
You'll have to have a federal Tech's ID.
Yeah, I don't have that. So there's, you can just be an intern. I will teach you a bunch of stuff. I will teach you all the ways of dear leader. I will be generous and thorough. Female interns get moved right to the front of the line. I will not sexually harass you until after the internship is over.
We support affirmative action.
I do. I'm Title IX as fuck. But we do have some extra work that interns would be needed. I love working with college students. I think they're... No, it's not like that. I think they're college students have a lot to learn, and they are appreciative of learning, and I like... They're not beat down by life. Like, people in their early 20s are just so much fun, and they're not cynical. They're not bastards like us. Right.
Suicidal yet. They don't realize the suicide hasn't hit in yet.
5 years right. It's turned me into a passionate libertarian, into a pissed off cynical libertarian.
Right. Exactly. So I love working with college students. If you're an intern, hit us up. If you're not in the Indianapolis area, hit me up anyways. If you're a college student, I'm working on a project that I want to test. Male or female, but I'm guessing we have mostly male listeners. I'm working on a social media project for colleges, and I want to talk to some college students. No, I would never do that.
No,
what am I?
Instagram, Twitter mashup.
Right.
Love it,
right. We're gonna.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't waste my time with that shit.
Libertarian pyramid schemers.
Yeah. So Creighton, let's talk about Charles Murray. So I'm gonna step out at this point, and I'm gonna let Greg. We're gonna ride solo. We got two recordings, so you guys should be fine. And what do you want to wear the headphones? Make sure that we're still recording.
That's maybe.
All right. It doesn't matter. It'll keep going. Nah, it's
if
fine.
It does break, I'm just gonna wake you up.
I'm not gonna fall asleep. I'm gonna
be autistic screeching to a minute.
Ah, you're fine. I'm gonna edit that other podcast and get that out tonight. So, explain what happened with Charles Murray.
So Charles Murray, he is a he's a doctor, but he was invited to Middlebury College in Vermont to come and give a talk about his book about the fracturing of America, which is basically commentary on white America and how it's breaking down. And it served as a sort of... he got the narrative right and saw the Trump sort of division break, the lines breaking in America in culture and society. And so he works for the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank out of Washington, D.C., and they have an affiliation with a group of young Republican/libertarianish club that invited... Huh?
Yeah. You're talking about, is it YAP or is it?
I think it's YAP, Young Americans for Freedom.
Yeah, that's the one that Buckley and all them started back in the 60s.
Until the people from California quit because they went full anarchy after Goldwater.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so he was invited to come speak. Well, he's a rather prominent individual at a very liberal campus. And so he ends up, it draws the ire once they decide to open it up.
It's another one of those stories of somebody speaking that somebody doesn't like and a bunch of people on campus just throw a hissy fit.
Right, and like, and Charles Murray's very, very, very incendiary. So he authored a book called The Bell Curve. Now, the Bell Curve was the accurate measurement of IQ differences between ethnicities. That got taken and served as a foundation for
part
a group
of... Part of it was. Like, it was, what is it? It says chapter 13 and 14 or something talks
about... Yeah, about the race, the racial differences.
About the racial, the IQ, and the...
What
was construed out of it was that
social Darwinism and
yeah, it was this whole like it plays into the alt-right narrative.
Correct. You like to pin everything on the alt-right.
Well, that's what it is. I've said in before the show started, I've met people from the alt-right who consider themselves alt-righters. The what's his face from
Richard Spencer
type people. It's, you know, that's what they are. They're white supremacists who believe that people of other races are naturally, evolutionarily, like, biologically...
You need to listen to our alt-right episode, because that isn't at all what they believe.
No, that's... Well, that
they believe that cultural clash happens based along ethno-states, and once you integrate, that's where the clash is.
Maybe part of them.
That's what he believes.
Maybe part of them.
Because he's not a white supremacist.
I talked to many, many people, and they consider themselves alt-righters, and...
Oh, yeah.
They are just classic white supremacists.
Yeah, his followers are...
Literally,
he's
like,
the philosophical justification for what they've wanted to believe for a long time.
If you're not European, then you are biologically predisposed to be dumber than the other races, than white people, basically. And or Asians as well.
That's what his followers believe. Yeah. There's, you know, I mean, yeah, that's definitely, that's something that, you know, I will try to represent everyone fairly, even the agorists who I hate and that kind of thing. Like, the followers sometimes end up are way worse, and so they taint whatever the person at the top.
I mean, I've heard Richard Spencer talk though, and he doesn't seem to me to have any kind of opinion other than what I just said. Like, I've heard him give interviews, and he just talks about how, you know. Like, maybe he says on TV, like, culture and stuff, but, like...
Culture, which, what he's talking about is that by having ethnostates that only, like, would conduct trade between individuals, like Israel. Israel has less
like
class.
Like Jew!
No, but, like, you like have a two-state solution by having a two-state solution, because what we've learned through history is that you look at white flight. People want to be around... They don't love diversity. They want to be... They self, sort of, separate, if given the option. And so that's where all the clashes tend to happen is through force when the government tries to use it as social engineering. And so his idea of a society is...
I think that's the most lighthearted way of interpreting all of what they believe. I think a lot of it...
That's the academic way of interpreting it. His followers take it and use it like Charles Murray's work was used as justification for white supremacy.
I guess I'm going to... I defer to the people that I've interacted with, and I just...
You're 100% right on the followers.
To me, it's like... I am nowhere near sympathetic to anything a liberal ever says, but on this issue, it's just like, how on earth can someone realistically be of the mindset? It's absurd to me. Like,
that there is a superior
pure
species?
Pure, unabashed racism. Like, it's not just saying, oh, make a joke about black people at a party. Like, just straight up,
not Donald Trump jokey kind of racism.
White people are literally superior to other races by definition of biology.
Like, well, Hitler's ideology.
Like, yeah, it's like, and that plays into more of what they believe. Like I've had when I've had these discussions with people, and I try and come at it from a perspective of like why that's wrong, you know. You can't make these claims. There's not evidence of this. Oh, well, the evidence has been suppressed. Like, oh, I've never heard this argument.
I have the documents, right?
But it's like...
come to this meeting. We're going to burn a cross, but don't look at that.
The political implications of it, beyond just them trying to say I'm right, is that for these people, the implication is that fascism, like in the pure academic sense of the word fascism, mm-hmm. not just like people saying, you know, not brown shirts, but like literally like
corporatist,
like
fascism,
fascists,
coordination at every level.
They believe, these alt-righters that I've talked to, they literally believe that fascism is in strict sense Nazism, like what the Nazis believe, it was okay to the extent, it was bad when they killed all these people, but it was okay to the extent that it allowed certain ethnic groups to have absolute control over important economic resources to prevent other ethnic groups from having control. Mm-hmm. So they believe in reinstating such kind of fascist ideologies. For example, it should only be white people in charge of the Fed because too many Jews control it. Like that kind of stuff. And they support fascism insofar as it allows white people to have absolute control over certain economic resources.
Based as their basis, like the development of Western civilization, they usually cite the ancient Greeks. You know, since that's Plato and Aristotle's battles are pretty much the foundation of Western civilization.
And like, and if you
and since that is the like that's the core and the base they build off of is that is inherently democratic and individualistic, and so that is why people that are lineage are from that line are naturally more sympathetic because of cultural traditions and norms.
And you bring up something like, well, if it wasn't for, like, you know, Middle Eastern Muslims, who are by no definition just white people, they're not Europeans. Like, if you bring up the fact that if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't even have access to all of these ancient Greek sources. We wouldn't even
algebra.
Like, we wouldn't have, like, algebra, right? Algebra. And all of these various, like, all of the scientific advances that the Muslims who pre and post Muhammad did, like, you know, you bring that up, well, they were olive-skinned. Like, they were, from that region, you look, they're olive-skinned, like Romans.
They were Persian, not Arab.
Right? And it's like, no, They were from the Egyptians were in Africa.
We're all Africans now.
Like it's just absurd. It's batshit crazy.
So. It's identitarianism. Like that's what they're identifying now.
It's like taking the idea, like the like liberals like to use identity politics to put people in groups so that they can control groups. I mean, my favorite quote about how liberals use identity politics comes from Malcolm X. He says, "There's nothing more dangerous," and I'm going to try and quote him as best as I can. So forgive me for using. The N-word, but not that N-word. He says there's nothing more dangerous to the American Negro than the American liberal, because the American liberal wants to use the Negro to fight the American conservative. They don't have the American Negro at heart. They don't have the interests of the Negro at heart. They have their own interests at heart in order to fight the conservatives. And that is 100% the identity politics that liberals have used for the past, 50, 60, 70 years, is that we have power over this identity. We use this identity politics and we can use it to have power. And we use this power to fight our enemies, which are the conservatives or whomever. And it comes off, and normal people who pay attention.
Normies.
Yeah, normal people who pay attention to politics can see right through this and see that it's just a superficial bullcrap and you're just using it to silence dissent. Until like at least Donald Trump, like you said, racist and your career is over.
Right, and that's the tipping point. Is you reach a tipping point where the fascism becomes trendy and interesting, or to a lot of people. Because I've talked to some of the same people who would consider themselves alt right, but aren't out overt racist. They've actually they've spent time researching what he says at the National Policy Institute and following the course of his career since he left Duke and the Conservative Union. And so what it's funny, their justification always comes back to this, is we would have never wanted to put you in camp, but you just wouldn't quit hitting us. Like, you just wouldn't keep pestering us and badgering us. And it's this violent, sudden backlash against years and years of pushing the envelope, trying to progress through
it's
cultural
like,
norms.
It's like that asshole at the party, who that smug asshole who keeps saying all these things, and everyone's too polite to say anything back to him, and then finally everybody's just like, you know what, screw you, and they go all rampant, and then now that asshole has no power over anymore. And that's
and like, yeah, to, we agree, two of us alone.
Yeah, to a large extent that's part of what it is, but again, there's
there are implications because we're in a political society with, we can use politics to craft policy.
Right,
and so that's the danger.
And then, because you get some of that backlash that is trying to flip this race-based politics that the left has used for years on its head and turn it back against them, it has some aspects of that group of people, they're all right, have just went too far, and they now are literally like white supremacists.
Absolutely.
And they
were always more sympathetic to that anyway. It's just that this is given license to go ahead and let it out.
Right, and it's like, I am totally okay with trying to flip identity politics on its head and remove that power from people, but, racism is still wrong. It does, just because people have been using the race card and abusing it doesn't mean that racism is okay, right? So,
especially since there's one race. The human. Like, there's different ethnicities, what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
And
I'm an anti-humanist. I'm on the side of Skynet. Skynet is a good thing.
Yeah, and I can't make that. I don't know how people can make that leap.
The leap to
just unabashed straight up racism.
Well, I don't know if you've listened a while, but Aaron Ewart had a barn party down in Martinsville, and I ended up showing up late, but ended up going. And as a troll, he invited a local, one of the founding members of the National Socialist Party of Indiana, the Workers' Party. He's an outright declared white supremacist. And so I never meet these people. Like, you just don't meet these people in life.
Yeah, but how did you run into this white supremacist? Well, I was at Walmart.
Well, the great part is he was invited to irritate Spangle because his Aaron knew that he drives Spangle crazy. So I was like, yeah, this is better. So I go and I spend the entire night, rather than doing anything else. He's a smart guy. Very smart. Incredibly well-read. And so, and his demeanor's not, too off-putting or whatever. So I end up spending the whole night talking to him from probably about 10 o'clock until 8 a.m. when he and his girlfriend leave. And it come to find out, it's entirely environmentally driven. It was family driven to an extent of trying to please someone. and make someone proud because of, you know, they had been, you know, been passed down, if you will, and then an environment of the criminal system being in it and being targeted. And so that's what drove his the way he felt, because he was someone that their reasoning never broke through to his. Why are you behaving this way? And so he just went ahead and categorically lumped.
Yeah, it's collective.
Created blowback.
Collectivism. It's like, for me as a libertarian, like I defer to individuality. I defer to
social unit of analysis is a person.
Right. I defer to people are independent. They have agency. They have a mindset. They can do what they want. Their actions are determined by their own thoughts. Now, whether or not your opinion on the world is shaped by the group you belong to, undoubtedly, absolutely. Like, my opinion on various things, like, can be determined by the groups that I'm a part of.
If we lived in Aleppo, Syria, we wouldn't be libertarians.
But that doesn't mean it is determined by it. It is influenced by it. And making that leap from influence to determinism is, I think, where your absolute...
There's a breakdown.
Yeah, the absolute collectivism comes in, and I can't make that leap. It's just, and if you put it in that way, if you say that you are, that you're, it almost comes down to a rejection of free will, ultimately. It's like, individuality, individual persons are not, their outlook in the world is not determined by themselves, it's determined by the people around them. It, ultimately, when you say it like that, it's just absurd. It's just like you're saying...
Well, that's actually a big argument of political philosophy. You know, is...
That's true. There is
that man
is,
in the state of nature.
Will,
is he a blank slate?
Will
is he a blank slate, or do his animal instincts?
Right.
You know, when they are expounded upon.
Does free will even exist if we have environmental? Like, that's a psychology argument too. That's been promoted. But for me, it's like it's clear. Like, yes, the way a person was raised, the groups that he's been around, he or she's been around their entire lives, you know, that absolutely affects their outlook on life. 100%. But when push comes to shove, a person is a person who has choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I am of the belief that your inherent reason ultimately determines your values. And it can be influenced by external factors, but it is not determined by them. And for people who are absolutely like white supremacists, or if they're not even, maybe they're just socialists, they're just Marxists, who don't necessarily believe that white people are superior, but they believe that the group is the dominant. Like, those people just believe in a collectivism where ideas and reason and agency is determined by the group, not by the individual. And that's just absurd. That is absolutely absurd. And on the right, that form is white supremacy.
Yeah.
Like, and I just don't know how people can get there. It's just so absurd.
Yeah, the ethno-nationalist viewpoint is definitely... But, I mean, that's something that's arising as a result, and it's totally, it's reactionary. This whole movement that's sweeping the world is all a reaction to years and years of liberalization and being told, no, change and progressive are good, acceptance, globalization. But what they're blaming, now that all of a sudden they have political actors who've figured out that if they give them the right scapegoat, they can win. And that's all this is, everything that's happened, Le Pen, Wilders in Holland, President Trump, Nigel Farage, fringe actor for his entire political career, until the economy, you reach a stage where the economy gets stagnant, the population's old, the outlook for growth is low, private investment stops coming in because the projections are low for growth, and it becomes a divvy up the pie society, and all of a sudden you have unemployed people, stagnant labor force, underemployed like in Spain. They're idle. They're looking for a scapegoat, someone to blame. Why don't I have it better? Whatever's the British dream, the American dream, or whatever. And that's a perfect population to be exploited, specifically in the United States, when you can pinpoint exact things that fit your narrative, like NAFTA.
Right.
You know, or you grew up. The other thing, too, is people have really underestimated. A baby boomer like Donald Trump lived a charmed life. They were born in the mid to late 1940s, they grew up in America's iconic Americana period, the 1950s, post-World War II, when there's no global competition for production.
And they say, why can't it stay like that forever?
Right. They don't remember the radicalism of the 60s so much because they were young and, you know, protected, sort of, and like all the hate of racism. Right.
And that also stands out to us looking back, but back then it was a fringe movement.
Absolutely.
Right? And it was,
they were being spied on, just
the
like...
The most normal Americans weren't at Woodstock. They were they were
pissed about Vietnam school, and, right? You know, they being lied to and why they lost so many friends, but they weren't, you know... Timothy Leary that tune right. in...
They weren't tune in, turn on, drop out kind of people.
Exactly.
They were just like...
That's just sort of like the symbolism of that era. But so they grew up during that, right, in their formative years. Culture was changing, idealism of the 70s. But then, you know, their careers kind of started to take off in the 80s under Ronald Reagan, in the return to nationalism. The 90s were perfect. What did you have to complain about the entire 19... Bill Clinton's in the White
that
House.
That buffer between the Cold War and 9/11.
Right, when their wealth's accumulating. And so you look at it for a white baby boomer... You lived a charmed life.
Absolutely.
In the perfect time for American history, where saying when you're the major political force, the highest concentration of voters, white baby boomers, of course, make America great again. Goddamn, you couldn't come up with a better phrase than that to a bunch of people that lived during that era.
I know, and it is it's the power of nostalgia.
It is,
and it's like for someone who like me, who you know, I'm not old and I'm not young, but I'm not old either. My perspective on history is more in tune with, you know, a reading of history, right? It spans more than my lifetime, and I didn't grow up during the 50s. I grew up during the 90s and 2000s.
We thought that was the norm. The 1990s was as great of modern right. economic era as
right.
we could have. No war.
But, like, humans are, you know, they are so short-sighted to a fault, and, you know... People tend to think of like 20, 30 years as a long time. And that's not a long time.
We're closer to Jesus Christ than he was to Alexander the Great. You know, like.
Yeah. And it's like we forget that our lifetimes are blips in the time span of humanity. And if you take a broader view of the history of mankind, something like, you know, perfect security and economic growth and stuff that's happened in the 90s and or in the
technological revolution to connect
especially when you had post-World War II, the only people left in the world that weren't hurt was us.
Yeah.
In Canada.
France is decimated
right.
so much so that like the French widow becomes a recurring narrative after
yeah.
World War I and World War II.
It's like if that's how you grow up, I mean that's how that kind of defines what you understand about the world. But if you step back and think about how out of the norm that is...
It's the perfect environment to thrive.
Right? And it's like we need to get back to that. And it's like, you don't realize that isn't the natural state of things.
Yeah,
right?
Context is what allowed much of that American, you know, dream to be possible.
Right.
For people that didn't have that much education.
Like there's a balance between interaction with other cultures and your own culture being its own culture. And then I think for the baby boomers, they're like, that was the perfect balance. It's like, this was our America, but we could still like watch movies from Europe if we wanted to. And it's like, and that's like, we saw Indiana Jones and we saw all these other countries and that's exciting. But when it comes down to it, you know, I live in, you know, Main Street America. I can still go to church, and there's nothing but old grandmas that I've known my whole life. Like, that's the balance. And now, like, if you get away from that balance, yeah, they're like, well, I remember it this way, and I want to get back to. So the problem must be all of these immigrants.
Perfect.
The problem must be all these other things that have changed the way I see America. When in reality, like, there's no such thing as a utopia. There's no such thing as a perfect world. Immigration, just to be that's the main topic when you're talking about things like Trump. It's like, you know, it is a net positive for economic growth. It's a net positive for all these things, but it's not a net positive for the industries that get displaced.
Right.
For the
creative destruction.
For the Rust Belt people, like, you know, they spend their whole lives, you know, learning a trade, like building a car. Or
you're
something.
A welder, and they say, "Well, here's a tax credit to go and become an IT contractor."
Like, don't get me wrong.
Okay.
Like that's to them, that's, you know, they're like, oh my god, this is horrible.
Well, only in DC think tanks is that a possibility. Like, only would such an absurd policy be proposed as a way to combat,
right.
you know, displacement.
So we know, like, it's a matter of, like, economic fact that free trade always results in a net positive for both sides, including us, That's, I mean, that's undebatable.
Yep.
But what is debatable is whether or not that is more politically practical or more politically popular than helping out the organized interest groups that are being hurt by the change in economic
specifically if they're
focus.
One of the largest political
right
forces.
So like if you can get a state, Rust Belt states who are hurting because their industry is changing, which is going to happen regardless. Trump can
There's no preventing technological change.
Trump can do anything. He can build the wall. He can tariff the crap out of every country. He can remove us from every single trade group agreement we have. He can protect. He can go so protect. But he is not going to change
the forces of economic
if
forces.
If there's anything that free market people have been talking about for centuries, it's that the market is more powerful than the state. And you do what you want, but that market is going to change.
Yeah, literally, since the Greeks, I mean, they were talking about the concept of autarky, which is an entirely self-subsistent economy internally, with no need for anyone else. And that's North Korea.
That's also what the Nazis tried to do.
Right.
They called it the Lebensraum. It was the idea that, and that was one of the motivating factors for why they felt like they had to invade. Of course, it's also, you know, just fact that
it's mercantilism.
But it was a motivating factor for why they had to invade all these other countries was because they felt that in order to be economically powerful, they needed to produce everything internally. Well, they didn't have the resources to produce everything internally, so they needed to expand.
Yeah, acquisition.
Get those resources. And that's totally 100% the field. And you're like, oh, Godwin's Law, we're talking about Nazis now. But you know this is a historical example of what it's not out of the realm of possibility that this is the logical end for a straight up protectionist society.
It's empire, and empire always ends in decline. It's like Margaret Thatcher said, you eventually run out of other people's money to spend.
Yeah.
You have to just keep growth is your only option to continue on until you can.
Yeah.
And that's the fate of where the United States is in this point in history, but the political concentration of which people have the most effect are people who are, you know, they grew up in the cocoon of Americana,
yeah,
not realizing the 1950s, also they're just coming out of World War II. I mean, there were problems. You know, 1950s is glorified.
It was fantastic if you were a teenage to young adult in the 50s. Great time to be alive.
And it's also a time, historically, the United States 1950s had the least amount of immigration. And so that plays a role that hasn't been talked about a lot culturally, as it was a white America.
Yeah. And
period.
It was great if you were a white guy.
And that's all there really was.
It was still really good if you were a white girl.
You stayed at home, nuclear family unit, you know, 2.5 kids, nuclear fence.
I mean, there was plenty of room for growth for them, but all things considered, they didn't have that bad of a life.
Right, and there were a lot of trusted institutions, like the labor unions were strong because they worked with management who worked with government, and it was like this coordination or corporatism that, well, I can make it, and we're all on the same side working towards the same goals. The realities of the market hadn't set in.
The key point to make is that did not break down because other races got involved.
No.
It did not break down because of immigrants.
It had nothing to do with them whatsoever.
If anything, immigrants would allow that to last longer.
Because only 50 years prior to, or 60 years prior to the glorified era, your grandparents were immigrants.
Right.
You know, that's like, your second generation.
Yeah, I mean, 99%.
You just don't remember that.
99% of Americans can trace their probably great-grandparents back to some other country.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, we're a nation of immigrants. They literally, I mean, technically, we're on my land. But assuming we weren't, you know, it's a nation. It's what makes the United States slightly different, too, is that it was a fresh start. It was a clean start, sort of, because
right.
The very first people were immigrants trying to get away from religious persecution. And then there was a pretty peace. I mean, it ended up not being so great for the indigenous people. But, you know, initially there was a coexistence and they worked it out. And then people came here for opportunity. And once they threw off, you know, the chains of King George, there really was an opportunity where we defined what kind of society we wanted. Which is different, because almost every other country in history has never had that opportunity.
From at least post-Civil War to, you know, the 1930s to right into the Great Depression, you know, the idea of America was this was a place where you could go to be yourself, to do what you wanted without some sort of state, some sort of group on your back saying that you have to do this, you have to do this. You know, you didn't, and people came here for the fact that we promoted this individualistic, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You can fail or succeed and fail on your own merits. Like, that was...
Not your family history.
Not the aristocracy. You know, that was what pushed a lot of people over here. And it seems like that's sort of like... It's flipped. It's like...
Well, yeah, it's where we are on our stage in development. Once you go past growth to stagnation, like, Japan's gone through this. They're where they are. We're just 20 years behind where they are, you know, at any given time, because they were the upstart. They were buying up all of America, you know. It was the Japanese invasion. You know, Mad Men was actually a book written about an advertising agency, and the guy that wrote the book brought to you by these wonderful people from Pearl Harbor, how they were going to have to sell the Mitsubishi car to the American people.
Right.
And, like, that's the thing, though, is once you get on the other side of growth, if you can't maintain it through immigration, which is immigration drives a ton of economic growth. Like, if we had amnesty... The growth projections would change. Private investment would change.
It would be horrible.
You would see. I mean, if we went amnesty, like in favor of opening
I'm
up.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm
because
sorry.
Population drives so much of growth. It's new mouths to feed. It's new, you know, supply creates its own demand. And
nothing can defeat an enemy better than just allowing people who would otherwise support the enemy. Whether that enemy is communism, or that enemy is Islamic fascism, or whatever, or Islamist radicalism, like, nothing can defeat that enemy better than getting their potential supporters to come in and realize how great a world you can live in if you just are allowed to live your life.
And they're given opportunity economically.
Right.
That's the big thing, because if you can basically normalize any radicalized group with economic opportunities, so, like, leave me alone. I'm building a life now. You know, and all of a sudden I'm not so interested. I don't have all day to sit at the mosque and read.
Yeah.
You know, like, get radicalized.
If instead of that you ban them from coming to your country, if they're from this country, and then at the same time you blow up their hospitals and kill their children, they're more than likely...
It's problematic.
Yeah.
they don't love it.
Yeah. It's like, they're not going to be your friends.
It's stunning when, you know, you're at a Yemeni wedding and it gets, you know, hit by a drone, that it creates... a vendetta that they can't wait to take
out
against
you. Who would have thought?
Stunning.
And I don't know.
And I'm not sure where this ties in, but it's a good point to make. It's an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
But, like, Charles Murray is somebody. Well, he's
to bring it back. That we digress. Bring it back to Charles Murray.
Reel it in, Snowflake.
Right.
Reel it in. But Charles Murray, his real assertion of the book The Bell Curve, which was so freaking controversial, was that IQs really drive income disparity. And so, in chapter 13 and 14, he argues that intelligence is a better predictor than parental socioeconomic status or education level of many outcomes, such as income, job performance, pregnancy, out of wedlock, and crime. Now,
which is not controversial.
No. And so, while the author is reported throughout the popular press as arguing these IQ differences are genetic, they write, "The debate about whether and how much genes and environment have to do with ethnic differences remains unresolved."
And I don't think I don't think you can resolve that, because the argument comes down to a correlation versus causation kind of argument. If we can correlate low IQs with certain races, does that mean certain races are causing low IQs?
No.
Yeah, you can't make that. You cannot make that leap, because that's just a logical fallacy. But people have made that leap.
Yeah, isolation in an environment like with the Aborigines, when they tested a lot of them back in the 1950s and 60s, and the average Aborigine person had a 60 to 80 IQ, and they hadn't discovered the wheel yet, was because of their isolation, social isolation. They'd been exposed
right.
to...
Because so
given
much
time, of, the IQs change.
Because so much knowledge that you gain in your life has to do with the interaction of all these people who already know it.
Literally all of it.
You don't go to school and sit in a room and figure out calculus for yourself. You go to a room, and you have other people who understand it teach you calculus.
Everything you learn is acquired.
Right.
And a reason, you're taught how to think, and then, you know, you reach a level where you can critically think
and
decide what
you
believe.
Build on that,
right?
That's why the attainment of knowledge throughout human history has been people learning something, teaching it to others, and they build on it.
Yeah, the monks with the transcription of, you know, that's how knowledge survived.
You have your great thinkers like your Archimedes and your Newtons and stuff, who make leaps and bounds beyond, but even Isaac Newton's one of his most famous quotes. He said, "If I have seen further than other men, it is because I have stood on the shoulder of giants."
Precisely. And so that is absolutely relevant with Charles Murray's findings, because you're not accounting for all the variables. You know, you're reaching, you measure something, and without the proper, I guess, context sitting around it to define it, and you know what's dictate what's driving that defining, you arrive at the wrong conclusion, and that becomes a justification.
Especially if you already have a bias for that conclusion.
If that's what you're looking for, yeah, it's exactly the fight you engulf in.
Right, it's
a confirmation bias.
If you have a bias and you see something that can confirm that bias, you're very quick to say this confirms my suspicions.
Now, keep in mind, Charles Murray isn't the one advocating
absolutely
for any policy prescriptions based upon his findings.
Right,
that was the work of Margaret Sanger. You know, being a Nazi eugenicist coming to the United States, and then she recruits the Southern Baptist Alliance of ministers, so she can their very preachers have women take birth control so that they don't have to be baby factories and stuck in
was
the home.
Was she Planned Parenthood
founder?
Right,
yes. Nazi eugenicist
Margaret Sanger. Planned Parenthood. She needs to. She was also supported abortions to make sure the black people didn't grow them up.
That was the whole idea. Was that she saw how women were being
held
down. That's
who founded Planned Parenthood, people.
Yeah, and she saw that's how women. You know, that's what repressed them from social or economic moving up the economic ladder. So her intention was good. It was that. Listen, you have all these babies keep you in the home, prevent you from participating in the economy. I'm going to coordinate with the pastors, the Southern Baptist League, or whatever it is, whatever they were called. I forget what the conference was, and then they're going to be the credibility that you're going to trust me to do this. This is going to give you the ability to not have to stay home and raise the children unless you decide to. It was about choice being presented. Now, that isn't necessarily a good or a bad thing, but
it's a thing.
To think that Charles Murray's research served as justification for eugenics is a lie.
Yeah.
When it's the sacred cow of the very side you're on, you know, the women's rights movement is completely about choice. That is the foundation of all of feminism.
And I guess to move it into why this is even being talked about is that he came to this school to talk
invited,
about...
Invited, yes.
He's invited to this school, and it's another one of those cases where somebody who says something that people don't like, and all of these leftist students show up and shout him down, and they silence it. And then it becomes into a concept of...
Physically violent.
Physically, I mean...
Over a policy implication, or the research he reaches... He offers no policy prescriptions off of it as what should go forward.
And now
it gets distorted.
And now you have to ask, what are we even talking about? Are we talking about Charles Murray, or are we talking about the fact that somebody who believes, based upon his own
free speech and free engagement,
like is it okay for anyone to say to this person, it's the free speech argument. Is all speech okay to be said?
Right.
And I
are you afraid of science? Is what they fear science.
And it's not even that though. Like they're not necessarily opposed to science. They're opposed to the implications that other people have drawn from that, and they believe that it's opposed to their ideology, racism, all this kind of stuff. They are opposed to it because they think that other people who have interpreted it in the wrong way. Therefore, it's wrong. We need to shout it down. That speech is not okay because it's hate speech.
Absolutely. Diversity is fine unless it bothers our conformity.
And it comes down to, right now, the debate amongst people of millennials, my group and a little bit
snowflakes.
Younger, is, is free speech okay, or is free speech without hate speech okay? And then you get into the debate, who draws that line?
Right. What is the distinction?
Where is the committee on what constitutes hate speech? Who runs that?
And are the sacrifices in liberty
right.
for such a society worth it and justification?
The idea is that there's two angles from this from my point of view. One, everyone has the right to speak. No one has the right to be heard. You can say what you want. You can be the crazy person on the corner shouting about UFOs and wearing a tinfoil hat. No one's obligated to listen to you, but you have every right in the world to say what you want to say. Now, a lot of people, like these people who shout this down, they say, no, you do not have the right to say what you want to say if that can be construed as hate speech. Therefore, you must be silenced, and that is wrong. That's over the line.
That's what Geert Wilders is fighting in a lawsuit. He's going to probably be the next president or head of Holland. He is under trial right now for a case where... He basically says, no more Moroccans, all Moroccans are bad, in a tweet, and he's on trial for said, and will probably be convicted for hate speech. And Canada just adopted restrictive hate speech laws.
And it's wrong. It's wrong for them to believe the things that they do, but it's more wrong to say that because they believe these things, they can't say anything. And you can...
I can't handle it being exposed to
yeah,
such incendiary
rhetoric. And it comes down to the whole snowflake argument. It's like, if you're so incapable of even dealing with anyone who has these ideas that you're so opposed to that you just can't even function, it's like you might have more problems than
it's
you
the
think.
Present year.
It's like
it's the present
like,
year.
It's like at some point you're just like psychologically, you're mentally ill. If you can't even be exposed to ideas that you believe are completely wrong without reacting the way you do, then you're just one, you're a child, or two, you're just mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, it is it's a violent reaction to things they actually believe they shouldn't have to be exposed to things they don't want to be.
Yeah.
And it's because that's, you know, they're sort of the neo-millennial generation, which were raised by the me generation, so it's not surprising they're even more extremely self-absorbed.
It's like, I'm 27, so I'm a millennial, but I'm probably...
You're probably
like a pure millennial, and everybody in that's younger, like the 20s and stuff. Now they're more Gen Z, I guess.
Yeah, they're like a neo millennial.
Yeah.
You know, they're the byproduct of self absorption.
So it's, you know, I wasn't, you know, I was raised, I think, a normal life. You know, my parents didn't necessarily want me watching Pulp Fiction when I was 5 years old, but at the same time, I wasn't. Prevented from understanding things that were that could be considered bad.
Nor were they going to protect you at 18 at a college university
It's like it used to be. You go off to college, and that's not only the place where you learn learn more advanced concepts in academia. It's also where you learn about life. Like you learn about
uncomfortable truths.
For a lot of these people, this is their first time living on their own. And
most of them aren't because it's, you know, the helicopter parent phenomenon.
Yeah.
They're calling college professors and saying, how's my son or daughter doing? Or,
yeah.
You know,
and
are you being the tutor as well as the professor?
And honestly, the reaction on the part of a lot of people to these kids who just cannot, they just cannot function in a world where people have such vehemently opposed ideas to theirs, like...
They shouldn't have to. They feel entitled to not have to.
Exactly. And the reaction to people... like me, like Charles Murray, like the people who ran the talk, the people who ran the school, it should be, I think, more aggressively opposed to these kids.
Absolutely, and to the credit, the president of the university wrote a condemning letter. The Atlantic, one of their writers, wrote just a wonderful piece condemning liberalism, saying this isn't what liberalism stands for.
Yeah.
This is scary. And so...
But the problem with that is that those people are also of the older generations.
That's right, they're the liberals. They're, my theory on this...
Because after Berkeley, after the Berkeley thing...
Stickman.
Did you see? Was that
by a stick?
Based on Milo.
Milo. Oh yeah.
I'm talking about the
he and Alex Jones coming and then
yeah. So after that, you had that was, you know, one of the bigger shout outs that happened. And they had news. It wasn't the newspaper. It was just a web source, and they had all of these kids write these articles about how all of this anti.
New York Times wrote this, and they had everybody write up examples. Yeah.
How they were justified. I read that. And it's just like, they're talking about how we can't allow hate speech to go
on. We have to
on.
Drive it out through force.
And you just, you, these are the kinds of people, like...
They're brown shirts.
They are. They are fascists.
It's fascism. The old new left, like the Weather Underground, Black Panthers, John Kerry protesting after Vietnam, these were idealistic people. These were people that mistrusted government after Nixon and being lied to and seeing their friends lose their lives in the war. These are people that fought, like, yes, they wanted to pursue aggressive tactics to change the status quo, but they moderated. They also were open to the exposure of new ideas. They didn't try to suppress conservative arguments. They didn't outright discredit and try to shame anyone that said tax cuts are good. As a white supremacist.
Because if you can't defeat an argument on its merits, then you
don't deserve
you
to be included.
Have an argument.
Right.
Like you're just a child yelling in the wind.
Absolutely. And so, but the new left, like the one I think is what's really happening, is we're seeing the Soviet left for the first time. We are seeing Leon Trotsky's brain children, like the cultural Marxists that left Frankfurt School, came to the United States at the University of Columbia, aggressively pursued cultural change. These people are now... their influences are being felt because the first people they taught are now the professors. And they're now the professors at these universities. So they're the third generation radicals. or the kids of the third generation radicals, and it is a violent suppression of any exposure to anything they don't want, even to the point, like, the Weather Underground people, yes, they tried to subvert and overthrow government. These people, instead of trying to attack the government, attack the opponent with a false flag on their on the side, like having
it's
the University of Missouri.
Them, it's not about being right. It's about silencing everyone else. There were
it's conformity.
That way, the only person who's left to speak is therefore they're right because they're the only one left talking.
And that's that. Or I don't know if you saw in chat. I posted the origins of the word racism. So like the word racism had been around, but it wasn't politicized until Leon Trotsky, and Trotsky and Stalin were violently opposed to the best way forward for the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and
right.
To Trotsky's death.
Yes, and it ended up costing him his life. But if you read his essay on National Socialism, which is just, you see his disdain for Hitler's willingness to use race as a driving force to create loyalty to the state. You know, he employed race in order to make people feel tribal and create a culture of tribalism. The reason that pissed off Trotsky so much and where he differed from Stalin was that Marx had the two ideas. The first idea was that communism would be ushered in through a global consciousness. People wouldn't look at it through a framework of nationalism. That failed in so many countries because when push came to shove, they reverted back within labor unions and the movements into their people and their origins, their, you know, creation myths. And so that drove Trotsky crazy to see how Hitler employed it so successfully. And so he created the term racist as a way to shame nonconformists who supported Hitler's type of ideas, which would ultimately be how you talk about a white supremacist for Richard Spencer, is that because you're using race to promote loyalty to the state, we're going to say that you are using research like Charles Murray's, and that is your justification that you are superior to other races. And you four are there, racist, and that's
therefore,
disgusting.
Therefore, you're not an intellectual, you're the court intellectual.
Exactly. And it ended up costing him his life. Yeah. But a lot of his followers were the counter-Stalin. You know, they were the down-for-the-struggle, idealistic resistance to Stalin's fascism. And they ended up fleeing to Germany in the Frankfurt School and creating a school of thought called cultural Marxism, which you hear about all the time today. And what it was the elimination of traditional societal norms, systemic, like 10 or 12-point list, breakdown of the family, a lot of the cultural change in the 1960s and 70s. And yet, even then, they did it through covert means. They never tried to suppress anything. It was just a constant badgering. And then they came over here to the United States at the University of Columbia, and basically with their political science and philosophy department. But that's what we're seeing is the final arrival. What comes after cultural Marxism and its lack of success are a bunch of people who now... They no longer are content just to push for change. You have to cocoon themselves from any exposure to anything other than conformity. And like snowflake's the perfect term because snowflakes only exist under perfect weather conditions.
Right.
Exposing it to any other kind of condition or any variance, and it melts.
And it's sad. It's infuriating for us because we come from the perspective of
free market, throw it at the wall.
Not just that, but me, like, in a personal level, like me as just like in my sort of moral character, you know, I obviously, dear listener, I have opinions, and my opinions are very strong. I believe in many of the things. I'm not necessarily dogmatic. I am very skeptical of opinions that don't necessarily agree with my point of view. So if somebody came out and said that the minimum wage worked, I would be extremely skeptical, and I would say why I don't believe it works.
But you also know how to attack it.
Like, yeah.
You're calling a logical...
But my point is that I'm not dogmatic in the sense that I will never accept something that doesn't agree with my point of view.
No.
But I do believe in my point of view very strongly, and I am based that upon, you know, my
getting
what
of
I've
it on
learned,
your own.
What I've you know, my life, what I've learned, what I've read, what I understand about history, all these kinds of things. So for me, when I hear people who just their reaction to other ideas isn't to at least to humor it, take it in, and refute it on its merits, but instead to attack literally like the violent personification of like an ad hominem attack,
Oh, right. That's what it is. Yeah. They know they can't compete in the arena of ideas, so they use every other tactic available.
And it's like, at that point, you start to wonder, and to be fair, I don't believe that a lot of these kids think about it this way.
No.
I think a lot of these kids are just young, immature, and they're reacting the way that they have been taught.
They're no different than Richard Spencer's followers of the alt-right.
Right.
You know, the critical thinkers at the top, they tell the hive what to think.
Yes, and the critical thinkers at the top, for me, what I start to believe after you see this enough is that to them it's not a matter of being right or wrong. It's a matter of we must succeed by any means necessary, and whether or not we can get people to agree with us is irrelevant. The people who disagree must not be there to disagree at all.
Winning for the sake of winning, even if it means abandoning principle, which is where we are.
Right, and those are the kinds of people. It's like, and I. It's funny that I used to work for YAL, Young Americans for Liberty, which is closely allied with the Leadership Institute, and the Leadership Institute is an organization out in Arlington, Virginia, that trains conservative activists on how to be effective on campuses, but also how to be effective in campaigns. You know, people like Mitch McConnell went to the youth leadership.
And that's
schools.
Totally different. That
well,
exists to pass along knowledge.
Yeah, my point is that there was a... I remember very clearly that there was a talk that was given by one of the professors, and these guys have all worked on campaigns, and one of them actually that gave this talk, I believe it was the guy who gave this talk, worked on the guy's campaign who Brad, whoever who beat Cantor.
Oh, really? He worked on his?
Yeah. So he's a smart guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then there's another guy who's Mike Rowe, who I swear to God, or not Mike Rowe, Mike Rothfeld, which anybody who's listening, dude's a legend. I don't care if you hate him or not, the dude's a genius. He gives a talk. Him and a bunch of people in his group, who mostly came through Right to Work, they give a talk on the real nature of politics. And one of the points that they make is that for them, there are two types of liberals. There are the liberals who just don't get it. They're the liberals. Those are the savables.
People that rant about ideological superstructures and sip tea in Portland.
They're the kind that they have been exposed to certain ideas and their ideas have been shaped, but they believe their ideas and they know that they think they'll work. They think socialism will work. They think these things will work.
That it's inevitable. It's almost like an eschatological agreement.
But it's not coming from a place of hate or malice. It's literally just... they are wrong, but they think they're right.
They think social experimentation is justified.
And then there's the liberals. Then there's the Democrats who know they're wrong, but they don't care because the path to power can go much smoother through the left. The Kevin Spacey,
Frank Underwood version.
Those are pure evil.
Yeah.
And
those are LBJ.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are the
kind. And FDR.
Those are the kind. Those are the kinds of people that I think drive much of at least on an upper level, much of what will eventually result in these kind of uproars. Like, those are the kinds of people who, they don't care that they're wrong. They're not interested in being right. They're not interested in they're not interested in shaping the world to be a better place. They're interested in being in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean...
which is so true of any tyrant. Yeah. Any tyrant, whatever the necessary ideology is to achieve power, is what they'll take. That's what they... I mean, even Constantine, he goes on deathbed, becomes a Christian. Because that's the power is trending that way.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's just the story of people that want power. And that's why Hillary Clinton, it's... You know, I think... I'm shocked it didn't kill her to lose. No one has spent an entire life planning to be president. Every single step of what she could control to arrive at that moment, and then the pain of watching everything project. So it's sure thing.
Yeah.
No one can possibly imagine TV star that ran as a hobby.
Yeah, to me, the more surprising aspect of the way that she lost, I guess we could talk about this, I haven't been on since the election, The more surprising way about how she lost is just how wrong
everyone was.
Everyone was, and don't get me wrong, polls are polls. They're not proof. The election is proof, but polls are based upon statistical methods. They're based upon.
There was one thing no one could account for.
I think the reason that the polls were so wrong is because they can't talk to young people and
white males.
They can't. Yeah, they're
white males supported him at higher levels than Reagan.
But
he made him feel good.
I think a fundamental problem with polling nowadays is that it relies too much on just landlines.
The sampling error is so enormous; it's worthless.
People don't understand how much that it's fallen behind.
Well, it's like radio and TV advertising. Like the methods they use,
but
the large of error is enormous.
You know, statistics works. Population probability, it works.
Provided you're getting good
data. Yeah, but as long as your sampling is good. If your sampling's bad, then it's going to give you false conclusions. Case in point, every single polling industry said that Hillary's going to win by like 6 points. And
New York Times that morning, 95% likelihood of election, and then the screenshot by 11:30 that night, 99% Donald Trump wins the presidential election, was the greatest feeling in history.
I will say, I don't care if it makes me a bad person or not, I was watching MSNBC when those results came in.
Best feeling ever.
Oh my God, just looking at Rachel Maddow's face. Oh God! I got a boner. It was
well. The reason I wanted that to happen more than anything is for them to show their true colors, which is what they've done.
Oh, absolutely! They're
forever
like
forever.
This is undemocratic. Like every single thing that they ranted and raved about conservatives for 8 years plus beyond was just like immediately they just went in, totally did. Everything that they said that they were never going to be.
They employed the deep state. Like,
oh my God.
Everything that could be thrown, it pulled the mask off of the Soviet totalitarianism of the American left that has been, if you really watch it close at all, it's always been around.
Oh, absolutely.
And that has been the grand schemers, the social planners trying to perfect society that always fail.
That's why, what's so infuriating for me is that, you know, you and I and people who probably listen to this podcast, you know, we pay so close attention that we see these things, you know? We see the superficial, like...
We remember the hypocrisy and fraud that people... Like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah, like, we can see, like... For me, my biggest pet peeve is when I hear people say things in political speak, and it's just so vacuous. You know, it's just hot air balloons. People saying things, and, like, I know... And this goes for people, like normal people, too, when they just repeat things that
good speak versus, like, Fowler speak.
Right, it's just vacuous. Like, people just, you know...
General
self,
platitudes.
Self-platitudes.
Synergy.
Self-righteousness. And it's like, I can see right through that. And I think a lot of political people, real hardcore politicos, can see right through that. But most normal lives...
Well, they use it because it works.
They don't see it.
They
like it, but they don't recognize it for what it is. And so for people like me, I see that, and I'm just so pissed off when people just fall for it, hook, line, and sinker. So
that's why I love Trump. Watching the difference between Ted Cruz and his following every rule to a literal T. Every rule of modern politics, campaigning, and political science. Ted
and
Cruz,
Donald Trump doing everything
wrong.
Opposite.
He literally said...
made it more endearing.
He's giving a speech in New Hampshire. A plane flies overhead. Or no. What was it? It was a plane or a goose. And he said... That's probably a Mexican UFO right now. And I am dying. Because everyone else is losing their mind about how stupid he is. And I'm like, you realize that Hillary Clinton's policy speech today won't make the news. Because you're going to be talking about he just called a Canadian goose a Mexican UFO. And then to say that I only like winners, anybody can be captured, was arguably the greatest insight into prisoner of war I've ever heard about anybody, including John McCain. And then to post Lindsey Graham's phone number, he doxed him.
Oh,
the first presidential doxing in history.
I mean...
It was shitposting in real life.
Anybody who's listened to this show for a while, like, I remember it was on this... At this very table, you know, 2 years ago or whatever, and this was right when everything was picking up, and Greg was like, don't count Donald Trump out. And I
never
was,
underestimate the stupidity of American people.
I was like, he's not going to do crap. He's blah, blah, blah. And I was so pig-headed about it. My
but
God.
It's impossible to imagine.
I was so wrong.
But it's so impossible to imagine. It's like, eventually it just gets fun. Because that's what happened for me is like, I don't... I fell victim to the same thing as liberals do. Like, eventually hitting liberals and making them mad matters more to me than any libertarian principle I have. I've flipped from being libertarian first, anti-left second, to I am just violently anti-left on everything.
And that's one of the reasons, like, I get really upset with a lot of, like, now, granted, if Donald Trump says something like, we need to increase civil asset forfeitures, I'm going to be like, that's retarded, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
And I'm going to call him out on that, even if the left is also calling him out.
Oh, absolutely.
But if he says something that just rustles the jimmies of the left,
on purpose,
I'm going to be all over that, and I'm totally okay with it. And there's a lot of lefty libertarians, people who...
SFL types.
SFLers.
That are going to have to be removed first.
They are the kinds of people who are like, they've always been more deferent towards being apologetic towards leftism anyway.
Oh,
actual leftism.
I hate them because all they care about is what other people think about them.
Yeah, and it's like, these people are like, you need to be anti-Trump before you can't hate the left more than you love liberty. And it's like,
I love Trump more than you, and you're going to fuck back.
And this is like, anybody who has a brain can make a distinction between, you know, what is loving liberty and what is just rustling jimmies. It's like, I don't for a minute want Jeff Sessions to do any of the things that he wants to do. For a second. At all.
Unless it's cut taxes.
And I don't want Donald Trump to do half of the stuff that he thinks that he wants to do. But when he goes out there and he says stuff that just absolutely blows the brains out of anything that the left can understand.
And they don't know how to fight on his level.
I'm going to love it.
Yeah, because it's grade school bullying. And they're like, damn it, am I really here?
The most cathartic aspect of it is that he has found a way to just completely remove the playbook from the left and the
forever.
He lit it on fire, it's gone.
It's
no one... Every single tactic that the left has used for the past, like, 50 years is gone. They cannot use it against this man. He knows, like, if you call him a racist, he's going to say something more racist to the point that it's campy and makes you look like an idiot.
Oh my God, take a picture with the damn taco bowl! And then post it publicly! I love the Mexicans!
And it's like, he's done it so well.
It's like just antagonized them to go farther up the ante. And then it lured them into a trap where no one's even listening anymore because they expect outrage.
Right?
Why would I listen to news tonight?
Like, anytime he posts something on Twitter, it's like, it's just another game-changing work thing.
He alleged Barack Obama personally authorized the tapping of the stones.
And that's it.
Because he probably has the intel that, you know, you can't prove it or disprove it.
This is one of my favorite... Honestly, I will say that this may not have been his idea, it might have been some of the people in his group, but this was so brilliant on his part. He did the executive order about blocking immigrants first, and then he did the Fed Reg order.
Oh, everything is sleight of hand.
Everything.
Yelling, screaming, meanwhile, two regulations for one.
The Fed Reg order that he did, I think, is the most important thing that he's done so far. You know, the remove two for every single one you want to pass. That is absurdly powerful.
And that is a
freaking deal. But it literally got 5 seconds of talk time because it came right after he said that if you're from Iraq, you can't come to America.
And then all these people, all these idiots, to speak to the idiocy of the left and how conformist they are, they go to the airport welcoming people that are visitors. Welcome to our... We had a visa to come here to travel. We're going back. It's not like we came here to... This isn't Ellis Island. We came here on a planned trip. Yes, it's inconvenient that our trip got blocked. We were going back home in 7 days. All these feminists in Indiana are at the Indianapolis airport, like, with welcome packages to our country and bringing in people in the community for assimilation. I'm like...
They just lampoon themselves. Like, they are literally the personification of their own... You know, they're the jester of themselves.
You become what you hate.
Yeah. And you don't even get it. You don't even...
Oh, the absurd self-awareness that they don't have.
You don't realize that you're your own mocking symbol. Like, you are your own...
You epitomize what you literally... You know, what you're literally shaking.
Right? It is the definition of trolling. It is the perfect definition.
That's what makes it so fun. Is one, we've never had, like, I've lived my life, born in 1985. I don't remember Reagan. politics sucked other than Ross Perot. I remember in first grade my teacher being for Perot. And after that, I didn't really care because everybody, it's so, you're splitting hairs. Most of the candidates, Al Gore, George W. Bush. Right. Other than inventing the internet, like, what's the real...
Literally to the point where it was a tie.
Yeah, a Southern Democrat and George W. Bush, the ultimate globalist Rockefeller Republican. Like, there's very little difference. And so, like, the fact that this was so new and distinct, and it just, it felt so good to realize that shame was over as being a tool.
Oh, that is very refreshing.
Because now there's no control, and that's what has pulled the mask off the left. And the fact that they cannot control through shame and public humiliation and, you know, outright condemnations, trying to get advertisers to get away from you. They're freaking horny for boycotts. Like, they can't wait to boycott everything, and the fact that none of that works anymore, and it's like...
they don't know what to do.
The fact that Mike Pence memes about electrocution exist means... the basic gestalt has set in because he's got electrocution memes saying repent.
They have no, and people are sharing them. It's like the worst, like you said the other day, the worst thing that Trump has done so far is let them get Michael... what's
Flynn.
Michael
should have never caved.
Yeah.
Should have promoted him.
The first mistake that he's made so far.
The left is a blood-sucking organization.
And now all they're doing is they're doing their damnedest to find anything they can linking any of these people to the Russians.
Except because, WikiLeaks just comes
out.
Yeah,
and then WikiLeaks comes out with this. But it's like, it's clear that that's exactly what they're like, oh, this worked, let's do it. And it's like, but they don't have anything left.
They're
like, we gotta argue about it.
Well,
ideas.
They result force, and which is like up at Middlebury College.
Right,
the left has been exposed because they've abandoned principle. They've abandoned shame doesn't work. Villainization doesn't work. All Solinsky's tactics.
We're literally going to throw Molotov cocktails.
It's all now. It's pure brute force, which is where this was always going.
Yeah, this is all. That's all they've ever had.
Every fight, you know, you're raised in a grade school. You know, might doesn't make right, or you know, violence is never the answer. Meanwhile, we're bombing the Muslims.
Yeah. What's that quote from Starship Troopers? He says, "Violent force has been no tactic in the history of mankind has solved more conflicts than violence."
Exactly, and it's true. And you know, it's a hypocrisy that they tried to brainwash away, and then at the end of the day, you know that you're going to take a bat to the bully.
Yeah,
and then he's not going to mess with you anymore.
It's like. It is very refreshing for it to be turned to the face. The only problem for me as a libertarian is that
it's not libertarian at all.
The guy has some horrible ideas, and the only thing that
he talks about a lot of horrible ideas.
Yeah, well, therefore he has them.
Nothing's happened.
Nothing. That is a positive point. Is that, you know, Congress hasn't done anything since he's been elected,
and a lot of people will think that's intentional.
Yeah. So it's very possible that he's one of the greatest presidents of all time because literally nothing happens under his tenure. But what he has done, without doing anything legally, is completely eradicated every single tool the left has over anybody.
He forced their hand. And that will change politics from here on in, because now, okay, you called me a racist, what's new? That's all you talk about anyway.
Like that picture you shared of Bane.
Yeah.
But I called you racist. This means you have power.
Yeah, you think that gives you power over me? That was what that moment was. He should have been tarred and feathered and tried in the second debate for saying that women wanted you to grab him by the pussy when you're a big star. They want you to do it. America, they walked him out there. They trotted him out there. They opened with that. With one line, when she says, if I'm president, or when they're talking about the emails, and he goes, you'd be in jail. And then he started stalking her around the debate stage. He won the election. Because all these people that felt bad that he said that thing to Billy Bush... all of a sudden, we're like, God, that feels kind of good.
Wrong.
You'd be in jail.
Wrong.
Wrong. Oh, wrong. And it just took off. And that ties into our earlier post about the mimetic, you know, the mimetic warfare.
Right.
He is a walking meme. Everything he does is a meme.
He's the personification of memes.
It is viral. It's instant.
Every single word he says is a meme.
You have to go back crying. I mean, everything he does.
No, swear to God. The minute I was like, what really, really sealed the deal for me to make me understand how different of an animal this man is when at the press conference the other day, that was really beautiful in how train wrecky it was by any standard other than Trump's.
It got lost.
A black reporter asks him, if he was going to try and work with the Congressional Black Caucus. And
he didn't know what the CBC was. He had to clarify.
And he says, I would love to. Do you have their phone number?
Do you know some?
You want to
set up a meeting? And now we're going to have the meeting.
And
Elijah
comes. It's like, nobody in the world could have ever have said that and got away with it. But then,
if you write it,
it's just like, it's your crazy uncle. And you're like, oh, you.
What was everything else he had done? He opened a press conference with a list of accomplishments he had done in his first 30 days that I've never... It was 100 things long. And it was driving everyone crazy. And then CNN tries to ask the question, no, you're fake news.
Yeah, you're fake news. Like, you can't...
You don't get access anymore.
It is incredibly refreshing in how barbaric everything is.
That's what politics is. That's
it's
what I
so,
love.
It's so, like, for, you know... I have always believed that politics is just aggressive, childish.
It's adult bullying.
It's aggressive, childish absurdity, walking around in a suit pretending that it's high class and high brow. And he comes in and just takes it and shows the emperor with no clothes. Politics is just, it's a circus. And this is everything that it has always been. And now you're seeing it for what it actually is.
And he pulled the veneer off.
Somebody
that little thin layer of veneer.
Somebody doesn't play the game, and the game becomes known for everybody.
Your policies are racist. You're a huge loser and a complete zero. And I think that you probably killed JFK.
You know, it's like your dad killed JFK.
And then the news can't stop talking about anything else, and the election's over.
And it's just, and it's like, at what point is the news finally going to realize that the best tactic they have is to give him no coverage?
They can't. They're completely dependent on him.
They don't.
He hacked the election by the press being for profit.
They don't. Yeah, they don't know what to do. Like they
have to cover.
They
him.
Hate this guy, but
they're dependent
every
on
single
completely.
Time they give him airtime,
he's press welfare.
He's showing them as retards.
Oh yeah. And he's literally saying, aren't you the biggest lying bunch of scumbags? And they have to read, tonight, President Donald Trump reported that we are the largest group of scumbags as have ever existed. It's like, oh my God!
Like, they don't get press, CNN, like, Alex Jones has more press access than CNN or something. And they're like...
He sells water filters and drops that are... operate outside FDA bounds because they're fake, and yet he's going to be White House.
Like it is incredibly.
I love our world.
It is incredibly refreshing. I just wish the man did not have such horrible ideas.
I do, but I can let it pass because I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I will say until he actually follows through on some of them, then.
Well, here's what I was thinking the other night at Middlebury College, because this sequence of events is so. Murray's invited, he's written books, and he's not a eugenicist or a social Darwinist or a white supremacist. The man advocates for a universal basic income. So it isn't like it's something where he wants to let the poor people die and it just so happens that this ethnicity, race, or socioeconomic group are the poor people. So he gets invited, he works for the American Enterprise Institute as their scholar. Their student organizers have him come to speak 45 minutes. He'd been invited, he's to speak on Coming Apart, the State of White America. And so... basically, the president of Middlebury, Lori L. Patton, she ended up getting involved because they opened it to the public. All of a sudden, the astroturfing organization started protesting, started writing letters to the local newspaper about why they need to oppose him. She steps in, president of Middlebury. She agrees she's going to introduce him, and that a political science professor, Allison Stanger, would lead a Q&A. So he's going to give a speech, then there's going to be a Q&A open to the public that she's going to lead. So hundreds of his students and alumni have signed this. Murray ends up coming anyway, including 55 faculty members who requested that their boss, President Patton, introduce him as a discredited ideologue, which is insane that that is how you would invite somebody with who you disagree. So he's scheduled to arrive at around 4:30. There's a protest outside of the student center, and they're joined not just by the student individuals of the campus, but also by community members, which means they bust people in. And so the AstroTurf took over. As the interest grew, clearly because of the polarization of the person they invited and as rumors started to spread, it has to be moved to Wilson Hall, which seats over 400. So he comes in. Protesters are yelling, screaming at him. Some great pictures we have in the show notes. We'll try to put up with everything. And at the typical
like angry student, just like
yeah, 1960s radical.
Right.
You're trying to relive those days,
just like the epitome of the Starbucks hipster,
yeah,
screaming,
the Portland non-gender folk,
right?
Just that I literally want to throw out of helicopters, but I'm not going to because I'm a libertarian. So they're heckling him, yelling. He tries to begin. So the students flood in, and they all wave signs. Some of them say scientific racism equals racism, respect existence or expect resistance, resist white supremacy, AEI must go, free speech does not equal hate speech, many, many other buzzwords in lingo and part of the zeitgeist of the radical Soviet American totalitarian left. But President Patton introduces him with this statement. The very premise of free speech on this campus is that the speaker has a right to be heard. This last comment was greeted with loud applause. However, as Murray is then introduced and strode toward the podium, they boo him loudly. Murray gets about 10 words into it, and a handful of the 100 students in the hall stood up. They so bravely turned their backs to him to symbolize they will not even allow their minds to take in any alternative viewpoints.
Why on earth did you even go?
To grandstand and show how much they care, since there are no actual civil rights issues in our era.
Right. So, before you continue, there's in our show notes, which again we'll probably post. You have a bit about the defense of protesters, the protesters written by somebody.
Yeah, Wayne State associate professor.
So, and this is a common thread that goes through any of these. Whenever there is a person who gets shouted down, there's always that person who defends the people who shouted them down, and it comes down to this: the argument that we make is that free speech is a right that everyone has, and you can say what you want. You're not obligated to listen, but you can say what you want. These people argue that why is their free speech more paramount than ours, implying that their literally censorship of somebody speaking is itself a form of free speech.
That the marketplace of speech has a hard limit on how much is allowed.
Right. So it's like, you are allowed to say what you want, but we're not allowed to silence you. They're trying to imply that their silencing, their censorship of someone's words is itself a form of free speech that deserves more protection. And of course,
it's entitlement to a vacuum.
And of course, there's a logical absurdity there. Well, if your censorship is a free speech, then I can censor your censorship and just, like, you know, physically remove you from the event or something. Like, you know,
in the name of toleration,
right? In the name of tolerance, like we disagree with you vehemently on a fundamental level, you know, so you're not allowed to be here, and we're going to shout you down, and you're gone. It's like, obviously, there's a logical absurdity there, but the fact that they could even rationally believe that this is something that makes any kind of sense is just a testament to how much of a failure their upbringing has been.
Absolutely, and that's the thing, is that they don't have a philosophical foundation or a logical foundation to their premise. Their premise is that we don't care for this, so that free speech shouldn't be free unless it's conditioned on these, you know, requirements. Well, given there are no actual foundational principles to it, it's pure... It's arbitrary.
All about
plucked out of the sky, what we don't like.
An arbitrary delineation of what is considered valid and invalid speech. For these people, invalid speech is hate speech, quote, but that hate speech is defined totally within their worldview.
Oh yeah, what they don't like.
Yeah.
They don't want to expose
it
to.
It's easy now. And this is one of the reasons, even though Glenn Greenwald is an avowed leftist in every sense of the word, I respect the man more than 90% of the people on the right, because his career, even though he's very leftist, has been defined on allowing people, protecting the right of people to speak truth to power, basically. His original, like, before he was a journalist, he was a lawyer. His early career was basically defending white supremacists in court so that they could say what so they couldn't be attacked. It's like...
He lived his principles.
Yeah.
And always has.
He is... I disagree with him on a lot of his stuff, but the stuff that he's known for is his stuff that I do agree with him on.
Absolutely.
He defended Ku Klux Klan members who were attacked not because they, you know, they didn't physically aggress against anybody. They were attacked because they were saying things that were very racist. And he said, no, they can say what they want. He disagreed with them vehemently, but he said they can say what they want.
They're given and granted this right.
And that's
what's missing, though. That's what the left is missing, is that they're no longer liberals, even. They're just purely conformist progressives with a vision of what they want.
There's one of those stupid picture memes, which I really, for some reason, and I don't know what it is, I really get, it gets under my skin when people share pictures of individuals and then put a quote in text on the picture. Like, to me, that's really...
That's a passage.
Anyway, the pet peeve of mine. But nevertheless, there's one going around of one of the governors of Louisiana from, you know, like the 20s or 30s or something. And it says, if fascism ever comes to America, it will be in the form of anti-fascism.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what's happening here.
You know, those, it's the, you know, the left has just never not been about absolute control. That's the idea, like the founding premise of collectivism is that if everyone would just do it, damn it, like we say, everything would be perfect.
Yeah.
If you idiots would just, they assume that experts have the answers, and so they err, when like push comes to shove, they err on the side of expertise at the expense of liberty, so putting it in the right hands. The opposition on the right, it is when push comes to shove, we err on the side of decentralization.
And institution, right. and tradition. Like, for me, I consider...
Custom.
Yeah, I consider myself a conservative libertarian.
Oh, absolutely.
I believe 100%... When push comes to shove, I'm an anarchist. I don't believe that there should be a state.
Theoretical
anarchist. I'm a theoretical anarchist. In a perfect world, mm-hmm. if I were to have have godlike power to reform the world as I see would be necessary...
If I were a completely hypocritical leftist, I'd be an anarcho-capitalist.
If I had that power, there would be no state. So I'm that kind of libertarian. However, in my personal life, as a person who you would talk to on the street, I'm more conservative than anything. And I believe in the power of tradition. I believe in the power of, you know, institutions.
History
has the power of community, not necessarily the power of, like, nation states. I believe, like, the power of your neighborhood, the power of your, like, your family, the family unit. I believe those things are powerful. I personally am not, I don't do drugs. I don't like drugs. I think the drugs are incredibly damaging to people's lifestyles, to people's worlds. They can ruin people's lives. Obviously, libertarian in me says I don't think there should be laws about it. But
it's not my right to tell you.
But for me personally, that's the perspective I come from. For a lot of these kids, it's hard to imagine that they have any other perspective than you're wrong and I'm going to beat you to a pulp until you agree with me. And if you don't, then you'll be dead.
Then you're going to submit to a law and we'll behead you and send the video out.
You should go to jail.
Yep.
You don't agree with you, you should be in jail.
Right. And then we'll re-educate you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the nature of the beast. That is what this young generation of snowflakes is. They don't like it. They don't think they should have to be exposed to it. And if necessary, they will take any means in order to prevent the free market and free exchange.
Which
ideas.
Is even more absurd that they seek it out.
Oh, well, they're provocateurs.
They seek it out. It's like, it's one thing if you're like, I don't agree with it. Like a normal person, a normal grown-up, can deal with the fact that there are people in this world who don't like them, and they just go on, live their lives, and be like, whatever, I don't care. And one of my favorite quotes...
I'll ignore that post on the internet and go on about my day.
One of my favorite quotes from Marcus Aurelius, and I'm going to paraphrase and therefore butcher, but it's more or less, he says, I have never understood why people love themselves more than any other, yet when it comes to the opinion of themselves, they put more precedence on the opinion that others have of them than the opinion that they have of themselves. And that more or less... describes much of these people.
It's the mindset of the American left.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what I think about me or my group. It matters whether or not other people accept my group. And if you don't accept my group, then you need to be removed.
Then we're alienated.
Yeah.
Disenfranchised.
Yeah. It's like other people's opinions of me are more important than whether or not I, you know, they justify any kind of action that I should take to correct said wrong opinions. And that's
the mindset, philosophical difference of someone on the right and someone on the left. Like, at the bare bones, is the left, it begins with the group, the collective.
Yeah.
The right, it begins with the individual looking out.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's why I like when people say, well, we'll court the Democrats. I'm like, you really won't, because when push comes to shove, they're going to vote for Bernie when one of those types are in.
So, Mr. and Mrs. Libertarian out there who has been... rubbing shoulders with the left and thinks that's now that Trump has won, we must resort to the left to build our libertarian coalition. One, that's been tried and it failed. And two, it will never work. It has never worked. So please stop while you're ahead.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
You might get the occasional disillusioned party member that drifts over from the left, But in an election, collectivists don't break rank. Yeah. And they are easily seduced by the Bernie argument.
If you want to build a coalition with the left, it better be on an issue.
So did Larry Rothbard, and he failed.
Yeah, it might be. You can work with the Dennis Kucinich on trying to stop the Iraq war. But if you try and say, we're going to work with Dennis Kucinich on everything, he is going to vote for Sanders. He's going to pull that lever before he pulls the lever for Rand Paul.
Because it's not that the government, the ability for government to drive out, that it comes corrupt and that there's something inherently flawed with having government watch over. For them, the answer to bad government is always more government, which is the dumbest idea ever.
It's a managerial philosophy.
It's totally, like, they're bureaucrats.
It's not, the problem isn't the law. The problem isn't the power. The problem isn't the ideas. The problem is who is in charge of this apparatus.
And if you get rid of elections, we can make sure the good people are always in charge.
Right. It's, if we were in charge, if we were the managers of this system, it would be great.
And to an extent, a lot of the conservative, socially conservative, feels the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why that's why we say it's hard to distinguish between the right and the left a lot of times, because ultimately what it comes down to is they just think they're not opposed.
They have the best
to it.
Idea.
Yeah, they just think they would be better managers.
Absolutely. And that's the scary thing, is it's really tough. But anyone, you know, anytime I see small advancements in regulations, in size of government, and scope, which, because it's so rare that anything's ever repealed in this country,
absolutely,
I support that individual if they're the most electable individual. And so that was something that resonated for me. But, you know, I think one thing I really like is, at the end of the day, what happened is the protesters would not let him speak. Charles Murray gets, they roar, chant, boo. Finally, an official returns to the podium and says, shut it down, and chants of leave our school by the crowd. Stanger, the professor, and Murray have to move to another venue for the remainder of his remarks, where it's live streamed to a giant screen in the theater for the people in the audience. And then they get up, right as Stanger doesn't want to do this, so she gets up, she's booed, she's a liberal, she shouts down and tries to explain how her questioning of Murray will rigorously challenge his ideas and that she is on their side. Finally, as the boos keep growing louder and louder, she just says, I think I have the answer. You're not going to let us speak, and it's a terrible shame. They go into the separate venue. They conduct the appointment. Most attendees predictably flee. They're not interested once he's not in the room. They're not going to stick around to hear the ideas. And so everything ends up being done, and they go to leave because there's a dinner plan. It's supposed to be a dinner plan on campus with the organizers and some invited guests. As they're leaving, they are outside waiting for them to leave with university officials screaming F white supremacy, F eugenics. College officials have to change the location because they found out where the dinner is going to be held with him. And this is all done covertly and organized in real time while they're trying to leave the building, and the car gets mobbed. So their car, these tolerant leftists, mob Murray, their professor, Stanger, as they're getting in the car, and grab Stanger's hair and twist her neck. And so she was put into a neck brace the following day, one of their own, the liberal on their side. And they can't announce it to anybody, so they have to move the dinner venue to a place outside of town where, he said, it, you know, it was actually pretty fun, given all the excitement. He said they had a bar, so we got pretty wasted in his letter about the next day. And so the next day, Middlebury's just up in arms over what happened. And so their president puts out a statement, and I thought it was important to read. Because she didn't support any of this from day one. This was the angry, astroturfed, and you know, clearly...
Yeah, how many of these people were actually students?
Well, that's the thing. Once they opened it up to outside the rest of the community, there's just no way. And if you look at the pictures, they're, you know, these people are 35-year-old baristas working on screenplays.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Middlebury College president puts out the statement, as many of you are aware by now, a large group of student protesters disrupted Charles Murray's talk yesterday afternoon in Wilson Hall. I'm deeply disappointed by the events that I witnessed and painful for the many people in our community to have to experience this. I know that many students and faculty and staff who are in attendance or waiting outside to participate were upset by the events and lost the opportunity for those in our community who wanted to listen and engage with Mr. Murray. With some effort, we were able to move to another location where he and Professor Stanger, who was scheduled to moderate the Q&A, were able to go ahead and have a probing conversation. Following the event, one group of demonstrators aggressively confronted. We believe that many of these protesters were agitated, but their indications Middlebury was involved as well, their students. And I'll just, long story short, how absolutely disappointed she is in the quality of their students, that they are unwilling to accept any outside view and opinion. Which is, when the liberal left are offering that commentary, on the state of the mindset of their students, it's a scary thought, because this is becoming the norm on, you know, basically there's been a Soviet Red Dawn by leftists on American college campuses.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. And now to be fair, I am a college student right now, and we haven't had anything necessarily as dramatic.
It's a liberal arts school.
Yeah, well, maybe. Berkeley's not a liberal arts school. I would say that a lot of it's, you know, it comes down to where is Middlebury at?
Vermont. It's like the idyllic North New England. Yeah,
they're the ones who want to secede from the United States because it's not socialist enough.
Right. Bernie Sanders, that radical champion of diversity in a 95% white state.
Right. So they are not necessarily representative of all college campuses. I'd say
they're representative of the American left.
Oh, absolutely. They're totally representative of a power. And you have to remember, politics is not the most people, too, it's the most organized. And you know, the left is going to be defined by how it's most organized. Right now, it's sort of like, these kids aren't the most organized by any stretch. If they were,
the loudest.
Yeah, but if they were, Bernie Sanders would have won. So, you know, Bernie Sanders didn't win. They're not necessarily very organized. So, but their time will come. It's more or less the same argument we've had with Will. The people who supported Ron Paul in 2008 were, you know, 90% young people. You know, eventually they're going to grow up. They're going to become adults, and they're going to be, you know, have families, and they're going to be the most powerful voting bloc. Will they still be the Ron Paul types people, or will they become just a typical?
They'll be Rand Paul and Justin Amash types. That's what I really see happening.
Yeah. But my point is, are they still going to be that kind of person, or are they going to just kind of be whatever and not? And the same, you could ask the same question here. These kids, you know, they're these kids. They're very loud, very. And I'm sure many of them think that they've got the biggest dicks in the world because they've done all this. You know, they're the coolest people because they got in the news for talking about this.
This is their Selma.
Yeah, they're gonna look back and be like, those were fun times. And when they get old, will they be the kind of people who are still that when they get older? And if so, it's gonna be pretty interesting electorate, you know, demographic, political kind of system, because, you know, it'll be
the Black Lives Matter Socialist Party of America.
Yeah.
Are you fucking nerds still talking?
Yeah. We're finished up.
We're pretty much finished up. We didn't know how to finish without you giving us.
You thought we've been waiting for you to come back into the close line,
dude. We thought.
Are you serious?
Yeah, dude.
Oh my god! 2 hours of just screech after screech after screech. Screech! No, I've been in there editing the podcast that's already up. Oh, absolutely. Easily.
You put usage up in that closed door in your bedroom?
Oh. I was.
Let me see the tabs on your computer.
I was beating off so hard.
You gotta load them all up in advance.
Every time I heard praxeology, I came. So
no hop on it at all. Instead, we shamed the shit out of the American left.
We should have talked about Hoppe a little bit because of what happened at ISLC.
I felt comfortable, like, just abandoning my own podcast for...
Peyton said Negro twice.
I didn't say
really?
He said, I'm going to say the N-word, and my eyes went wide.
Not that N-word.
No!
Is there anything I need to edit out?
No, I was quoting Malcolm X.
Yeah, it was a comic quote. Actually, what I just said, repeating Creighton, was more offensive than his quote.
Yeah, so, alright, very good.
So Spangle has nothing to add because he hasn't been paying attention for the past 2 hours.
I've been in there.
Humble, dear listener, have been listening for 2 hours, and we thank you for it, and hopefully.
I'm really unnecessary to my own podcast. Just upload. I'm the upload monkey.
He does give it direction at times.
Absolutely. Well, I knew with you.
There are times when we're engaged because we find things interesting, and there are times when it's like,
I couldn't talk about this subject, and
when we do this podcast, it's usually at least me and Greg, if I'm here, drinking beer, and more or less, we just sit here, drink beer.
The first time I knew we had magic in a bottle for this podcast was when it was late into the night, we were drunk, and you were explaining the difference between empiricism and why it has to be 100% correct, and Hoppe's a priori, explaining a priori, and I thought, if people listen to this,
libertarian boners.
But it was popular, and I was like, oh, God.
Yeah. No, I felt comfortable because Creighton's very chatty and very opinionated, and so are you, and you differ on certain things. So I knew that you guys, and as soon as I got up to walk away, you were arguing about... Well, you were arguing about Robert Spencer, and I was like, all right, excellent.
I don't actually disagree so much is that, you know, for me, it's that anytime you lead a movement, you're defined by your followers.
Right.
His followers are toxic.
Right.
Absolutely. If there's one thing to take away from this episode, it's just like...
Please explain it to me like I've not been in the room. I've been in the other room snap...
Tell me like I'm five.
No, I mean, the first 30, 45 minutes we talked about that, and it's just how this is, I guess, a question I ask you.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that somebody could make the leap from towards overt,
we're the supreme race,
literally 100% white supremacy? A young person.
I don't know. I mean, I grew up in the 90s, and when I was a kid, and Greg's not much further behind me, how old are you? You're 27, so you're a little old. Like,
an older snowflake.
Yeah.
I'm still in my 20s.
Yeah. So,
I've got 3 years
of youth life. So when I was growing up, I mean, even in the late 80s, early 90s, it was all everybody's equal. You had equality jammed down your throat.
Different. You know, you're sitting there looking at a physical difference. Like, if you see it, you're a racist.
Right.
Like, you know, at a certain
see,
point.
See, that's something.
But let me finish so I don't sound like a racist. And so, I mean, when you are. When you're brainwashed into seeing equality, which I'm all for. I mean, obviously, Harry's here. Harry's one of my best friends. You know.
He was here. He left.
Seth is gay, and he's one of my best friends. I mean, we tease them about their differences, just as they tease me about mine. I mean, you know, it just happens that Harry's is his skin color, but there's a lot to Harry to tease about, apparently.
More racist than Harry towards his own people.
Oh, shit, yeah. So, hold on.
We tease them more about being a tech nerd than anything.
Exactly right. So, I don't think it's damn near impossible to see people as less than. Like, I think racism is one of the dumbest things that you can possibly engage in. You have to be a stupid person to look at Harry and think that he is less of a human being because of his skin color. That's such an arbitrary, dumb thing to, like... Right? Right. It's such a, like... I think people who cheat on their wives or husbands are bad people.
And it's not even...
But,
ignore the morality of it. Let's not say that the white supremacists think that black people or Mexicans or anybody are bad people. They just think that they're lesser people.
Right.
How do you come to that conclusion?
I don't know. But I think that our culture engages in it all the time. We consider Muslims less than, and so we don't really have a problem with what's going on in Syria because we just don't care. We don't give a shit about the genocide and the mass torture and starvation of the Syrian people. Why? Well,
not in our immediate group.
It isn't. We don't connect with them. We also don't get the information that surrounds their humanity. And I think that if you saw things in human terms, which is why we're not allowed to see them unless you really seek it out, then we'd want to do something.
You realize that more Muslims have been killed by Islamic radicalism than any,
yeah,
you know, European descent people. It's
right.
One of the worst things that what really pisses me off is when I'm talking to people about Islamic terrorism and all this jazz, and they talk about it as if they're like some sort of barbaric rabble, like some sort of inhumane, you know,
Cretans.
Like, yeah, just like. Like, just, you know, like, just...
They're not American leftists.
Like, Neanderthals.
Right.
And you try and explain how important specifically Middle Eastern people have been to
math.
The development of Western civilization. Not,
yeah.
Not Eastern, not Muslim, Western civilization. It's just... if it's not surprising to them, I don't understand how they could just cast it.
So I think it's
Muslims. You literally would have had no Renaissance.
Like, I think it's just an intelligence thing. Like, you know, you mentioned the Nazi that we know, and that was a familial ideology that had been passed down onto him. It's about fundamentally, humans are social creatures. We're pack animals, and so part of our pack, part of the belonging to a pack, is an ideology of racism. They will believe that, you know. But for me, I just don't. Obviously, mine is one of my pack. One of our values is equality, is inclusion, is diversity. But we don't sit there and brag about it. You know what I mean? Like, that's part of we are libertarians. We desperately try to get women in. We try to
trust me.
Such as
we consider buying an underwear company. We're so desperate to get into women's underwear.
Listen, I have been dealing with 50 different interns over the last couple days for work, and the most talented interns were women. You know,
which is why is that surprising?
Because the cultural narrative is that, well, women are inferior, or that they're not blah 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 blah. They're less creative. They're less funny. And I think that cultural, but I sat there and I watched this one female intern who was the best of the crop, and she was working as a production assistant. And at the end, everybody was supposed to walk over and give her their phone number. Well, literally 95% of the male interns in their early 20s, when they were told to walk over and give their phone number to Jordan, they walked to a man. They walked to me. They walked to a different guy. And she had to stand up and wave and go, I'm Jordan. And I think that there is a little bit of, it's sexism. I mean, it's such a high ratio of people overlooking her. And women are so overlooked in society. Women have a hard time being listened to in the society. And the answer to fixing that problem is awareness. And so the reason that I mentioned that they were the most talented is that I think that when you're a woman and you have that experience of being talked over all the time or not being listened to all the time, it pisses you off and you work harder.
I ever talk over you, it's because I talk over him.
Oh yeah, that's why he hasn't been on in a year and a half. Yeah, we're giving him a 3-episode run, but then we're not going to have him back for a year because he just talks over everybody.
You're going to call me whenever you're having an episode, because I'd mute that chat because you guys, that chat, break my damn phone. But you're going to call me because if you guys have it on Thursdays at 7, you like usual,
mm-hmm.
I can make it. You gotta convince
me. Literally haven't changed the time in 5 years.
You have to convince me to put off homework for an hour.
All right. An hour? Yeah. It's 12:15 in the morning.
I'm on spring
break.
Because
you never know what's going to pop up or what we have to do.
Right.
I'm on spring break right now. I can be... Greg, do you want to... We can actually go to the...
PCB?
You want to
hop in a Jeep Wrangler and go down to Panama City?
You go to the Mucky Duck?
The Mucky Duck Pub?
Right there, yeah.
So I think you've got a society that is... That is, millennials are 60% racially diverse.
Is it millennials are the ones that are, when they grow up, the United States will be, white people will be minority?
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of already grown up, but.
Well, you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
Like when, by the time we're baby boomers age, we'll be the purely European ancestry will be the minority.
Right. So.
We'll be all biracial.
But I do think that in terms of how women are perceived and how women are treated. No, there is not that overt Mad Men sexist bullshit, but there's definitely still something. You know what I mean? Like, there's definitely still, I'm going to go to a man because a man has these qualities. But at the same time, I also cannot fucking stand that masculinity is somehow wrong. The idea that masculinity is wrong is just as wrong as saying that femininity is wrong, or that being feminine means that you are Pamela Anderson. Well, you can be a butch lesbian feminist and be feminine, and that's great. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot...
There's a council that decides.
Exactly right. And so a lot of what I think we believe in here, and a lot of it, to be quite frank, stems from Maya. You know, 5 years ago was Jeremiah, and now is Maya. And that... Right, that process of... Right, that process of... It wasn't that funny. every Jeremiah in the world hates it. They hate it. Right. Jeremiah, you weren't get ready. But Maya is somebody who has challenged the idea of social norms for me, where why is it the norm? You know, why, you know, where I have not been sexist in terms of get in there and make me a sandwich, hun. We joke about it, but I'm not actually like I love and respect women, and I try in all my professional endeavors to be cognizant of the fact that women do get talked over a lot, and that they are treated by a lot of male coworkers as less than, and
it's not even noticed.
It isn't. Men don't even realize they're doing it. Yeah, well, that's different. But in the workplace, it's very difficult for women. And I don't necessarily believe in the pay gap, although I'm sure that there are many anecdotal evidences of women being paid less. But in terms of but there is definitely an authority gap for women, and that is something that. It just isn't talked about. The way to fix it is not any legislation, not any law. It's awareness.
I think the way to maybe not necessarily fix it. For me, it's always been, whether it's women or black people, any kind of minority group, I've always come from the perspective of just like, I just worry about myself.
Mm-hmm.
I just worry about...
Right.
And it's like, I am maybe I'm a weirdo, but from my perspective, I believe that you fail and you succeed on your own merits.
Right.
And if I didn't do well at something, it's not somebody else's fault.
Right.
It's my own fault. You know, unless somebody literally, like, put a stick in my bicycle wheel when I was in the Tour of France or something. It's like, it's my own fault. So, I see a lot of these people, obviously a lot of this mentality comes from some sort of resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And
see, personally, I think it's biological. Like, the man, like, Western style rugged individualism as a white male is almost genetically predisposed outset, because the man, you know, the man, and it's self-reinforcing. Every part of our cultural experience is that go west, young man, is that, you know, the American creation experience, Christopher Columbus adventure, like, masculinity is John Wayne. And then for the woman, they're much more community oriented.
He was the man.
I do say, like, I'm a very direct person, and when I am at work, I'm at work, and I'm task oriented, and I'm boom, 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 because I've got a busy day every day, all the time. I'm accomplishing a lot. I need things to get off the checklist. Yep. And so when I talk to people, I'm like, hey, can I get this, please? Can I do this, please?
It's transactional.
And the women that I interact with fucking hate it. Because I am...
Why don't you get your own coffee, Chris?
Well, no, it's not that. It's, hey, I need to get this task done. Can you give me this, please? Thank you. But because I ask it that way instead of, hey, girl...
What do you think about this?
No, it's not. No, but the fact that when I talk to female coworkers the exact same way that I would talk to a male coworker, they get offended. That pisses me off.
Which means that the male defines the cultural norm.
Right. So I'm just trying to treat you like I treat like everybody else.
The exact same.
Exactly right.
I love the show The Young Pope. I don't know if anyone's watched it.
Not yet.
In The Young Pope, there's an opening scene where he's sitting there being served by the staff for the first time in the Vatican. And the old lady cook comes in, and she tries to be all, you know, best friends and very personable and say, I'll make you whatever you want, very grandmotherly. And he stops her and says, one, I only drink Diet Dr. Pepper.
And two, I only believe in professional relationships. Professional relationships are clear. Personal relationships get foggy and messy, and then there ends up being communication differences.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a really interesting insight into, like, the male approach.
Yeah.
Versus more of the female approach, where it's holistic or heuristic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they consider the other side before they offer a response.
Right.
The male, it is transact. I need this. Okay, that's logical. I need this.
And right.
It's almost like the cost of
business. We are the Spocks.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. The rational.
I'm not considering your feelings because I need to get this job done.
And that's a mindset.
Right.
That is, I don't know if it's necessarily biological, but it's definitely reinforced.
Why is he so mean to me? He doesn't care about me.
Now we're devolving into a discussion of, like, men are from Mars and women are from
Venus. All right, so let me just say this. Let me finish this. This will be my final thought, and then we'll go around the table, and then we'll wrap this up, because you people need to get the fuck out of my house.
Yeah, thanks for wrapping up the podcast that we took control of for 2 hours.
I treat people the way that they treat me, okay? If you treat me nice, I treat you nice. If you treat me with disrespect, I treat you with disrespect. I treat people the way that I want to be treated. I have treated Rob Kendall so nice.
Oh my God.
I have been such a good friend. I have been so nice to Rob Kendall. I have been a great friend to him. They all the time.
God, just come to Morty's.
And apologize.
I've literally not been on the show for 2 years, and I'm already sick of hearing him talk about this.
I'm just going to have to keep mentioning it, because I have treated Rob the way that I want to be treated, and Rob was very mean to me, and I just don't think it was nice, so I'd like an apology.
Oh, my God.
This is going to be Matt Damon, Jimmy Kimmel, like, years.
He was very disrespectful to me. I sent him a note. I said, hi, Rob, on a note. And he wrote back. What did he write back to me? No. I was trying... I wrote just a note to my former friend Rob, who has disrespected me. I was trying to break the ice,
an olive branch.
And what did I get in return, Greg?
You were a complete zero.
See, it's very disrespectful, and I want an apology. If you apologize to me, here, this is how magnanimous I am.
He has got a marker in his hand, and he's pointing at it.
If you come and apologize, not only will I forgive you, which is gift enough, I will also find out what happened to your washer and dryers.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, boy, did you just up the ante.
I'm going to take her on a date.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to ask her why... She has abandoned my favorite dog, and I'm going to figure out what happened with those.
Really, if I come to this conversation right now, I think you guys were insane, because I know
everyone else, because they won't get the reference, but it will be so targeted and right at the core.
I'm enormous. Trying to help him, okay? Even though he is so mean to me, I'm treating him with love and respect.
It was started out as
I'm
fake.
Gonna bring these boxing gloves.
No, it started as a fake WWE scripted style attacks, and then they pushed a little more. It's a lot like we're talking about with the we didn't want to put him in camp, but they just wouldn't quit poking us.
Listen, I've been nothing but nice.
Okay,
right. Creighton.
I'm talked out, but yeah. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I mean, I know that I am more right-leaning, and I have very specific thoughts about the mindset and the Soviet totalitarianism of the new American left. So that is going to probably incense people, and I know you left libertarians. You know how little respect I have for you.
Get it.
I'm not coming for you.
Is that what happened in this episode?
We attacked the left slightly more. But I always attack them. I don't like the left. I admit it. I hate the left.
Yeah.
I hate them.
I'm like.
Did I just get cat AIDS? What happened? I'm scratched up.
CIA umbrella dart.
I'm like.
Ow!
Plutonium.
My favorite quote from Trey Parker and Matt Stone is, I hate conservatives. I really fucking hate liberals.
Yeah.
I don't mind I don't hate conservatives. I hate Republicans, and I really hate
liberals. Yeah, that's
liberals.
That's a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Me, my final thoughts.
Oh, you didn't go. Go ahead. All right.
You went clockwise.
All right, sir.
I shouldn't have to hear your thoughts because they might offend me, and I wish you would leave. And it's the only way toleration can exist is if you would go.
My final thoughts are, I feel like a lot of this we're preaching to the choir. Right?
No.
We've got 6,000 followers, but I have a feeling.
I have
a feeling that 99% of those people probably were like libertarian podcasts on Google, right?
Oh yeah. I think that's how we've added the most of the people.
Liberty Caucus style.
But my point is that a lot of what we say when we talk about the left is probably preaching to the choir. And the people who do not agree with us probably zoned out and stopped listening to this episode about an hour and a half.
We don't care. We do this for us, not for them. See, if I cared about
it's
what
4:30 in the morning, we're still talking in the microphones. We're not doing this for you guys. speak for yourself. But my point is that I feel like a lot of this we're preaching to the choir, and it's hard. It's very cathartic when we are here and we're talking about how stupid the left is and how stupid these kids are and how stupid the alt-right is and how stupid so much of stuff that's going on. And it's like, for me, like, I've honestly grown. I'm probably every bit as opinionated and ideological as I have ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think it's very fair to say that I'm far less political.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
I literally worked in Washington, D.C. for a nonprofit libertarian organization for a year and a half.
Not if we have anything to say about it.
Other than getting elected, I mean, how more political can you get?
Right.
And it's not that in my life I don't ever plan. Once you get bit by this bug, it's really hard to get rid of it. And I don't think that in the rest of my life I'll ever not be an opinionated asshole who thinks that you're wrong on everything you say.
Right.
But for me, like, looking at it from that perspective, I'm like, how do we? And this is the question I posit to the listeners: how do we as weirdos who pay attention to this more than a normal person ever should get these things changed, right?
Right.
What are the solutions? That's the thing. That's a big criticism, or that's the next step for us. We've addressed our grievances, and now it's our turn to step in the arena.
Like, are we just hot air balloons just huffing and puffing? I think if you listen to me throughout this podcast, if you go back, I guess probably 100 episodes by now, to when I was on consistently, I feel like I've probably had the same question throughout. Is, I wouldn't say that we think we have all of the answers, but we at least know the arena that the answers lie within, Like, we know the ballpark that they're in.
Yeah.
And how do we get these people who are literally on Mars with respect to that to kind of at least come our way? And I don't know.
Well, the answer that I've come up with is, fuck it, let's just have a good time. Right. Let's get together, let's talk about this stuff. Go get involved, but at the end of the day, let's have some laughs while we're doing it.
Yeah.
Have a good time. So because
to get diehard tribes like Christ and promise them afterlife, yeah. Do exactly what
you
right.
Even that took centuries for that to really be done.
All right, kids. We will see you Monday night. Please join us. We did two episodes tonight to get to 200, so you can hear it right away. Thank us. We are heroes.
This is $1.99 right now.
This is $1.99. You can if you want download yourself and listen to yourself on the way home. I just uploaded to $1.98.
That is not 9/11.
How many episodes of, like, we're approaching like, hardcore 6-7 season TV show.
Absolutely. There's 240 items in the feed. Our friends at Lions of Liberty are at 300, but they do like 3 shows a week. So, and they've done it half the time we have. So we really need to get our shit together. But I did get divorced in there. I don't think I could do that. I mean, basically, if we just
let people that are, you know, frequent contributors do their
we could have our Senor Ruiz do a culture episode like he's been wanting to do for years.
He did for 36 episodes, and then he quit. No, I don't think Joe's coming back. I think Joe is
Joe is
fulfilled and happy as a pig in S teaching kids in high school, and it is awesome, and he's converting many kids to libertarianism.
Totally.
And if you are listening and you are Mr. Ruiz's student, thank you. Thank you for promoting the podcast to your students, Joe. Yeah.
Thank you. Nothing I love more than libertarian
maybe a
propaganda.
Slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a good idea.
It's fine. All right, thanks for joining us here on this episode. We will see you Monday. Thank you so much. Please share this episode. Please donate. I found out from Lions of Liberty, and people donate $25 an episode on Patreon to Roger Paxton, okay, for Lava Flow. People donate
right?
$10.
That sounds like commentary.
Roger Paxton is a good
product. He is a great guy.
What product are you implying about that?
I'm just saying I think our highest might be two, maybe five. No, it's two. I think it's two. I know I say $1 per episode, but I'm going to make that $25 per episode.
I think it's great his wife supports him like that.
Absolutely. I'm just saying, the 3 shows that we promote at the top of the hour, I found out how much more money they're making than us, and I'm pissed at you people. So, get it together. Alright, that may have been too far. I apologize. I'm going to apologize to the audience. Like, Rob Kendall should apologize to all of you for his hurtful words. Greg is dying because Greg's such good friends with both of us.
There's no reason for any of this, and it's just like, but I know your two personalities, there will be no standing down.
I haven't done anything wrong. I have just been the victim of internet bullying. All right, thanks for joining us here in this episode of Weird Libertarians, and as always, we promise
to do better next time.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Get our other shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.